Thank you, Nick. The time is approaching 10 o'clock, and if in my 53 years on this earth there has been a more powerful piece of drama in any format, whether it's on the stage, whether it's on the silver screen, or whether it is on the small screen, then the moment Jack Duckworth, I'm going to well up even thinking about this, the moment Jack Duckworth found Vera sleeping for forever, if you like, in the armchair, in the room where the ducks, the iconic ducks, are flying across the sitting room wall, then I haven't seen it yet. I just absolutely, I can't think about anything else, which is a bit of an imperfect start to a programme that's going to have to dive straight into the news agenda. We'll begin, I think, with the masks.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, Keir Starmer has urged European leaders to curb human rights laws to help tackle illegal migration. Talks on reinterpreting the European Convention on Human Rights, or ECHR, are due to get underway in Strasbourg. The Prime Minister's warned changes are needed to halt the rise of far-right populists. A separate report says failures in Britain's asylum system are a result of short-term reactive policies. The public spending watchdog looked at 5,000 asylum cases lodged 3 years ago and found 56% remained unresolved. Ministers say they're implementing sweeping changes. Ruth Kelly is chief analyst at the National Audit Office. LBC has been told a former Metropolitan Police officer was accused of being part of a grooming gang, but the case was brushed under the carpet. Two women who grew up in care made allegations against the custody sergeant in 2012, but the case was dropped because of a lack of evidence. We can now reveal he was allowed to retire under investigation. The Met says it's reviewing the case and has encouraged anyone with information to come forward. The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, has told LBC that ministers are keeping a very close eye on Australia's social media ban. But Lisa Nandy's indicated the UK has no plans to impose similar restrictions. Under-16s in Australia have spent their first day without platforms, including TikTok and Instagram. Figures from Ofcom suggest British children aged 8 to 14 are spending nearly 3 hours online every day. The communication regulator has warned youngsters are spending significant periods of time on devices late into the night. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was up 6 points at 96.48. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.14. LBC weather, brighter for most places, blustery with outbreaks of heavy rain in Scotland, a high of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Hey Sainsbury's, have you got anything to help my money go further?
Well, if you want to make some big savings, make sure to use Nectar Prices and your Nectar Prices at Sainsbury's. Together they can save you over £450 a year on your food shop.
Bring it on.
Download the Nectar app and tap into great savings. Sainsbury's, good food for all of us. 18 plus Nectar app required. For full terms, see help.sainsburys.co.uk/help/nectar-prices.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 3 minutes after ten. It was the Ogdens, wasn't it? It was Stan and Hilda who had the ducks flying across their wall, not the Duckworths. Too distracted by the plight of Vera passing away in her armchair before Jack Duckworth came to find her and just embarked upon a sort of lyrical or just poetical paean to his dead wife. If you're just tuning in, I should probably explain that Nick finished his show with a commemoration of the Coronation Street anniversary. And you'll find this quite hard to believe given my well-documented champagne socialism. But I used to watch that show religiously back in the day, right through to probably the early days of Steve McDonald's courtship with the character that Sir Anne Jones played. And later as well, Sally Lindsay, I remember her heyday. Julie Hesmanhouse, both of those ladies have been on Full Disclosure. And not by accident, it's no coincidence that the great actors who began on soaps and then went on to do magnificent things have a real soft spot in the hearts of people who enjoyed the programmes. But I could have done better, perhaps, than getting the flying ducks. I had some ducks once. Mrs. O'Brien got rid of them shortly after we got married. But I think they were Guinness toucans, actually. I had a Guinness toucans on the wall of my bachelor pad that were flying across in the style of the ducks on Stan and Hilda Ogden's sitting room wall. Where, of course, Eddie Yates was a lodger. But I could do this all day. I could reminisce about Coronation Street all day, but I am not going to. I'm not going to. Is it possible that the Duckworths kept the Ogden's ducks on their wall? I mean, could I have got that right? I mean, it's all messed up and messed up in my memory. I'm not going to issue any spoiler alerts for revealing that Vera Duckworth passed away in Coronation Street. Goodness knows how long ago it was, but you can count it in the decades, not the years. So, I mean, there's an interesting story today that's just caught my eye as I sat down, actually. Would I catch a bus? No, not out of choice, says Andy Collett. I feel much happier using my own car. This, for any people still inexplicably dreaming of a career in journalism, this is how you write an introduction. This is by the BBC's West of England correspondent, and somebody else. There's two names on the byline, Dan Johnson and Sophie Woodcock, but this is how you write, this is how you drop your lead. Would I catch a bus? No, not out of choice now, says Andy Collett. I feel much happier using my own car. What? What's that got to do with the price of tea? What's that got to do with the price of eggs? Second sentence. His sentiment isn't unusual among passengers, but Mr. Collett is a bus driver. That is a brilliant intro. You go, oh, crikey, tell me more, you think to yourself. Eleanor generally doesn't let me do phone-ins about buses. I think it's because she's a bit of a snob. I catch a bus every day. I catch at least two buses pretty much every day. Sometimes I catch more than that. Sometimes I catch a bus even though it's not the quickest way to get from A to B, because I quite like sitting on the top deck of a bus and watching parts of London go by. The most beautiful, magnificent city in the world, whatever Donald Trump may be lying about this week. But I love buses, and yet I do recognise some elements of the story published today, reporting 40,000 incidents of antisocial behaviour, an increase of 24% on the previous year. And this story comes from the West of England and looks at the West Midlands, but the figures are national. Here's one from Mr. Collett. I was attacked by about 30 school kids, he says. I had cuts, bruises. They bent the fingers back on my hand when I was trying to hold the door to stop them getting on the vehicle. But as I say, I'm the producer, who obviously her word is law, never allows me to do phone-ins about buses, which is a shame, because the last time we did a phone-in about buses, do you remember, we found the strangest bus in England. We found the bus that literally, I won't get it exactly right, but it literally ran on something like the third Thursday of every month in the months that had an R in them, or something like that. We found that bus. We had people listening to the programme. I don't know if they were listening all the time or whether they just rang around each other to alert the community to the fact that buses were on the agenda at LBC. I was in clover that day. I was like a pig in poo. I was so happy. But anyway, that's why I'm not allowed nice things. That's why I'm not allowed nice things. I was sitting on the tube this morning, not the bus. I was on the bus this morning, but this isn't when I saw someone wearing a mask. And it happened last night as well. So I was thinking to myself yesterday evening, I wonder if it's time for us to have a conversation about masks. Because you notice them popping up in the wild, don't you? And you find yourself, well, I don't know. This might be the first question I ask you this morning. What do you find yourself thinking and feeling? I don't know if you were listening to this program in the very, very early days of the pandemic, but I was slightly embarrassed by my reaction to masks. I was slightly embarrassed by my feelings, my reflexes, when it came to the face masks that we were, with increasing clamour, encouraged to wear during that period of history. And I couldn't understand why my reaction was childish, not childlike, sadly, big fan of childlike, but childish. I kind of had a touch of the, well, don't tell me what to do's. And I remember thinking also, as I walked around a relatively deserted West End, I always get my memories mixed up in my head of when we were coming into work here, despite the fact that most people weren't. And then, of course, we weren't coming in either. We were doing the show from the shed. I say we. It was just me. That was the strangest period of my career. I know everybody had weird experiences during COVID, but imagine getting out of bed in the morning, walking downstairs, having a cup of coffee, and then I presume someone was delivering the papers, were they? Was the news agent, the local news, probably Raj, was delivering the newspapers. And walking up my own garden, or down, if you prefer, to a glorified shed, like a fancy pants garden office, and presenting the show there without any colleagues in sight, you know, in vision. I don't think I could see colleagues on screens even at the time, because all we were concerned about was getting the audio to you. That was weird. There were moments, you know, when the phone line went down and I didn't know. So I'd still be talking. But because the line had gone down, they couldn't talk to me in my ear. So you'd get to the... and I would never look at my phone, of course, during the main part of the programme. So I'd get to the quarter past. I'd hit the junction, you know, my customary 20 minutes late. And my phone would ring. And they'd say, oh, we haven't been able to hear you for the last 5 minutes, but don't worry, we think we're going to be all right when we come back. That's an almost philosophical conundrum. If a radio presenter is talking into a microphone, I suppose this is a challenge that some of our rivals face on a daily basis. If a radio presenter is talking into a microphone and nobody can hear them, then are they actually presenting a radio program? I'm not even going to answer that. I'm just going to leave that hanging. That's your little treat for today. If a radio presenter is talking into a microphone under the impression that he's addressing his customary, I don't know, 1 and a bit million, 1.4, 1.5 million listeners, but no one can actually hear him or her, then is he actually presenting a radio program? I do not know. So, I want to talk about masks, because I am very surprised to find that I'm still in quite a strange place with regard to them. The strangest thing I felt in those very early days, and I'm still embarrassed to tell you this, even though I told you at the time. No, I'm really embarrassed to tell you this, actually, because I'm pausing to think whether or not I should. But I did definitely tell you at the time, so there's nothing to lose, really, in telling you again. When they first started appearing, and I saw men wearing them around town, I thought that they were wimpish. I use that word advisedly. I don't want to sort of go any further than that. I just thought they were wimpish. I thought it was a display of weakness to wear a mask, which is partly due to my schooling, probably. How many times have I told you about the idea of PE teachers shouting at you when you broke your collarbone? It's only pain, it doesn't really hurt. And matron giving you a fisherman's friend when you'd broken your leg and sending you back out onto the rugby pitch. And that is, of course, what happens at certain types of schools. The schools that David Cameron and Boris Johnson went to mean that when Boris Johnson got COVID, David Cameron announced that he'd be fine because he'd seen him play tennis. So we're all a little bit affected by it, a little bit guilty, I suppose, of the consequences of a schooling that doesn't allow you to acknowledge or admit vulnerability. It doesn't happen to me very often, happily, these days, but it used to happen all the time. It used to be a large part of who I thought I was. But that idea that here is adversity, even if it's a virus, even if it's an illness, here is adversity, and here is something you do to protect yourself from it. And here is somebody stating, I don't need this because I'm strong. I am mighty. I am me. And I felt that. I felt it in my bones as I made my way around London. It took me a while to get fully on board, even as I knew that listening to, you know, Bob from Basingstoke live on LBC rubbishing the medical research, or, you know, some sort of bonkers Daily Mail columnist claiming to know more than all the doctors did. And even when we acknowledged what I found to be the base point of all of these conversations, better safe than sorry, even if it turns out that masks haven't helped at all, why wouldn't you wear one now just in case they do? But none of those arguments landed with some corners of the community, and initially none of them landed with me, even as I was making them on the radio, particularly that last one. And all this noise, this ridiculous brouhaha, but probably the biggest indication we'd had before sort of white supremacism swamped Twitter, probably the biggest indication we had of how susceptible we were to online lies. You'd take calls from people saying, oh, I've done my own research, and you'd sort of say, why? You know, we have an NHS. On what possible planet would the NHS be giving us deliberately bad advice in order to what? And no one could ever go beyond one or two sentences in those kind of conversations. But, of course, online they never had to. they could just find a weirdo or a grifter or a Daily Mail columnist wanging on about, I would never wear a mask, it is an infringement of my Magna Carta right. And you're just like, what is wrong with you? But then you noticed that you were, guilty of it yourself. And that's what I want to talk about. So listen, if you're not aware of the reason why, the health chief, I like that headline, David Elkiles, the chief executive of NHS providers, which represents NHS trusts, has said, and this, it's important to get this right, is people with flu or cold symptoms should return to the habit of wearing a mask in public amid what he describes as a tidal wave of illness. You've got children still at school. It's quite mild. What's the first thing you notice when you step out of the home in the morning? I suspect you notice that it's mild. Your gloves probably stay in your coat pocket at the moment, which is odd for December, but it's mild. That's bad in the context of spreading flu-like conditions. It's wet, which is also perfect for flu, if not for you and me. And when we were talking about anything like COVID, says the chief executive of NHS providers, we need to get back into the habit that if you're coughing and sneezing, but you're not unwell enough to miss work, to not go to work, then you must wear a mask when you're in public spaces, especially, I would say, on public transport, to stop the chances of you giving your virus to somebody else. We got quite good at it during COVID, and he says we really, really need to get back to that now. We really, really need to get back to that now. God, some of the memories are coming in thick and fast. I can't remember who it was that called them face nappies, but it was indicative of a mentality that, in retrospect, looks absolutely insane. People genuinely furious, to the point of apoplexy at being asked to do something that was largely understood to protect others from their own symptoms, from your illness. So, with your permission, that's what I want to try to work out today. You will remember seeing people from Asia wearing masks quite often before COVID. You'd quite often see people from China and Japan and other countries in that part of the world for whom wearing masks during times of virus was second nature, the most natural thing in the world. And I remember when someone explained to me on the program that it is done to protect others. It's not done to protect yourself from other people's symptoms. It's to protect other people from your symptoms. I remember wondering whether there is some sort of cultural subtext to this and that we're on the wrong side of it. We are less likely to do something mildly inconvenient to protect other people from the condition that we're suffering from. So have a pause and have a think. Why did we have, explain to me any antipathy to face masks, okay? So, I don't know that I'm in the mood to talk to somebody who is bonkers. I mean, who knows? Let's find out. But the idea that you know more about it than, for example, the chief executive of NHS providers, the people whose jobs literally stand and fall by trying to reduce the number of people who are calling upon the NHS for help. I mean, why on earth would they do anything that doesn't actively and measurably lighten the burden on the NHS is a question for the ages, or possibly, you know, your favourite online grifter. But for the rest of us who kind of on some level know who we should trust at moments like this, we know who we should listen to. We're never going to put Billy Buncher numbers ahead of our GP or the head of the NHS in our mental calculations. And yet there's something negative, is that the right word? Why don't we all wear masks? There you go, that's the phone in. Why don't we just all do it? What is going on psychologically? And is there something peculiarly British about this? I suspect there might be. Have a crack, if you can, either at explaining your own bizarre antipathy. I am actually ashamed of some of my reflex responses here, because they make no sense, and B, they're the opposite of altruistic. They expose other people to potential harm. But also the broader question, the broader psychological question of resistance. Why don't we, if some senior NHS people say we should all wear masks, why don't we all just wear masks? What's going on there? What stops us? What prevents us? And you can be either personal or public on this. So you can either talk, as I have done, from the perspective of your own very peculiar position, very, very personal and specific position, or you can join me in casting your net a little bit wider. I guess if you work in the sector, if you're a professional, why do you think it is? You can blame people if you want. You can blame media if you want. We end up blaming elements of the media for almost everything every day. But was that, how big a part of it was that? Because it was a standing start for us, wasn't it? At the outbreak of COVID. It was just that masks were not a thing, really, in this country. As I say, if you saw somebody wearing a mask, they were probably Japanese or Chinese, and wearing it, we subsequently discovered, in order to protect us from whatever symptoms they thought they might have. So we had a standing start. We had year zero. It could have, presumably, it could have gone the other way, but masks could have become an absolutely baked-in and accepted part of our response to viruses every winter. To viruses and colds every single winter, but they haven't. Still a sense that this NHS chief executive is sort of preaching to the unconverted, urging us to do what is obviously right in the knowledge that most of us won't, a lot of us won't. One bloke on the tube this morning wearing a mask, countless people sniffling and sneezing. And do you know what I did? I moved seat. I moved away from the bloke wearing the mask because he was coughing and spluttering underneath his mask. So I moved away from him and ended up sitting next to someone else who was also coughing and spluttering. They got on later, who wasn't wearing a mask. So I moved... Anyway, that's possibly a little bit dull in the context of my morning commute. But that's the question I've got for you. Why? Why are we resistant, sceptical, negative about face masks when normally, if the medical experts tell us to do something, they tell us to jump, we normally just say how high? Hit the numbers now, you will get through, by the way. 0345 6060 973. Why? Why are we like this? And are we both, or rather, are we also talking about something peculiarly British or not? Hit the numbers now, you will get through.
LBC.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. Sky Sports will play more than 50 Premier League games and the PDC Darts Championship. While over on Sky TV, Amadeus and Sweet Pea, Stranger Things is on Netflix.
Get Sky Sports, Sky TV and Netflix for a most wonderful price in time for Christmas. Go to sky.com. Sky, believe in better. Requires Sky Stream and relevant Sky TV subscriptions. Minimum broadband speed of 25 megabits per second recommended. 18 plus.
Abandon your turkey. Rip your knitted jumper from your chest. The festive double bucket from $20.99. 6 pieces of original recipe chicken. 6 mini fillets. 2 large gravy. 4 regular fries. 1 large bottle drink. Get the deal. Believe in chicken. Until the 4th of Jan. Subject to availability. Participating restaurants only. See kfc.co.uk for T's and C's.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quadrapillar Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot Bears. And 4 giant slides on the brand new Wave Runner 2. Let's plunge!
What's next, Dad?
Cannon Arena Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Trampolines, Magical Wood and Cafes.
Nutcatch Adventure Park.
The sunrise.
Book now at nutcatch.com.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It is 23 minutes after 10. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. And let me stress something that's quite important, because you wouldn't believe the number of messages I get from people that say, oh, sorry about that last message, I'm listening on catch-up. It is 2025. It is December 2025. And we are talking about face masks in a medical context. So please don't think that you've accidentally tuned into a show that is 4 years old, or something terrible has happened in the studio and they've started playing out old tapes. The reason why we are having this conversation is pretty straightforward. People with flu or cold symptoms should return toot sweet to the habit of wearing a mask in public amid a tidal wave of illness. And we know that we won't. Not in anything like the numbers necessary. Well, at least that's my starting point this morning, born partly of my own weirdness. I think if I was very, very spluttery, I would probably wear a mask, but I can't even say for certain, and I'm sorry, because I know that I should. So what is wrong with us? All of us, me included. Possibly not you, but that doesn't stop you from pontificating on what's wrong with the rest of us. In fact, if you just see this as a no-brainer, James, of course I'm going to wear a mask. How on earth do you account for all the people that won't? Or won't quite do it enough? Or won't do it right? Or won't do it at all? Sush is in Ashford. Sush, what would you like to say?
Morning, James.
Hello.
Morning. I'm off sick at the moment from work. I think they've said I've got some kind of inner ear infection. But okay. Anyway, last week I thought I was going to die. I woke up at 3 a.m. and I've never had vertigo before. And we had to call the ambulance, came out, actually.
Nice.
And then I've never had something that scary happen to me, ever. Like, the room was spinning. And I couldn't open my eyes for 12 hours until I got some medication. I'm still unsteady on my feet. And then I ended up in A&E on Friday because my doctor was like, I'm going to make sure, you know, there's nothing untoward going on here.
Okay.
And anyway, then I was telling your producer that this old-fashioned sister who I could have hugged shouted at us all in the A&E and said, everyone, put your masks on.
Really?
There's a flu. Yeah. This is in Chertsey. She said, there's a flu epidemic on now. Put your mask on. And I thought, that's great.
How many people did?
There were many that didn't.
Give me a breakdown here. Give me a rough, because I was in A&E on Saturday as well, oddly enough.
Right.
And a nurse didn't do anything like that. And I don't think, I mean, there was probably a mask dispenser in the doorway.
Yeah.
And to be fair, we didn't hang around very long in the main bit. We were sort of ushered straight through. But everything's fine before people express concern and are very kind. But everything's absolutely fine. But it was a brief and serious wobble. But we were fenced off. We were behind a curtain in a private booth very, very quickly. And so I don't know what I would have done if they'd come in and barked at us to put on a mask. But I would say less than half. I hope I would have, Sush. You're very kind. But I bet less than half did that day in Chertsey, or about half.
In Chertsey, I think there were people like me that had them. And I think I was so hot there because I wasn't feeling well anyway.
Yeah.
But I kind of just put it below my nose for like 5 minutes. So as soon as she did that, I put it back on.
Sure.
Because I follow, you know,
rules. Why do you think that? Because I generally follow rules, but I don't necessarily follow this one. But anyway, don't worry about that. Just give me the rough numbers, if you can remember, because you were delirious. Maybe you were hallucinating.
That was, pretty close to the mark. I would say maybe 70% put them on.
Okay. Oh, that's good. After the nurse made the instruction, not before. Well, that's encouraging, although the 30% is still worryingly high. Just briefly, why do you think people don't see this as clearly as you do?
I think until you've been as ill as I've been, I think you don't realise this is really rubbish. And I'm not sure if I've even had flu or whether I've had some inner ear infection. Do you know what I mean?
Like, no, I do know. And the infection can move to other parts of the body. So, by the way, don't take any medical advice from me. But it doesn't matter. If you've been really, really sick and someone in charge tells you, you can minimise the likelihood of other people catching whatever it is that you've got. Possibly you can, or probably you can, or definitely you can, depending on what it is that you've got. Why on earth wouldn't you do it? And I don't know, because Sush is the kind of caller, the kind of human being, the kind of citizen I was talking about, the one for whom it's a no-brainer. And yet I'm here, I'm an idiot, you know? I just am, because there is part of me that still thinks wearing a mask is like a sign of weakness, and that I wouldn't do it unless a nurse came into the waiting room and shouted at us, in which case I definitely would. Because I'd feel like even more of an idiot to be sitting there after a nurse had told me to do something and not doing it, but 30% of people were happy to be double idiots. And that's just one A&E in one town in one evening. Kip's in Colchester. Kip, what would you like to say?
Hello. I think it's sort of a bit of... I think it's being very British, because we're kind of admitting that there's something wrong with us by wearing a mask. We're going out there and we're almost saying, look at me, there's something wrong with me.
Except that. I nearly interrupted Sush a moment ago, because I didn't want anyone who was just tuning in to think that this was a phone in where you can just ring in and tell me how poorly you are. You know, because if you say, is there anybody, particularly if you say, is there anybody old out there feeling poorly, they'll ring in with a list of symptoms as long as your arm. And yet we think it's a British condition to not admit that we're poorly. Maybe it changes with age. Maybe at the point in your life when you feel it's necessary to tell people how old you are. So I'll get a caller and they go, I'm 78 years old. I'll never get a caller saying I'm 24 years old or I'm 53 years old. At that day, whenever that day comes, that's the day on which we're comfortable telling people that we're ill. But until that day comes, we hate telling people that we're ill, and a mask tells people that we're ill, so we won't do it.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like a big red flag on your face saying, look at me, I'm poorly, avoid me. You know, it's like the plague cross on the door.
So
it's,
women will be, under this analysis, women will be more likely to wear masks. I haven't got any statistics, because women
no,
are more...
I think you're absolutely right, because like you had the conversation a few weeks ago when you were talking about men and sort of not admitting their sort of health problems.
I think it was prostate cancer particularly, but we broadened it out. Yes.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of very similar situation. I mean, I'm feeling like I've got a bit of a something coming on, and I'm like, oh, I really should wear a mask.
Yeah.
But part of me is I don't want people looking at me, but that's stupid because I do like YouTube and stuff, so people do look at me a lot. But I don't know, it's a bit of a weird situation, but I can kind of understand it. It's very British.
Well, maybe it is, until someone tells us. Nope, it's exactly the same in Kuala Lumpur. We have, well, maybe not Kuala Lumpur, but it's exactly the same in Poland. It's exactly the same in Belgium. I don't know. I just find it psychologically fascinating, behaviourally fascinating, especially now. Because you would have thought if we took anything away from the COVID heyday, and listen, COVID hasn't gone away. We often talk about it as if it's gone away. One of the biggest drivers of a lot of the problems the country faces, both economically, medically, and demographically, is going to be consequences of COVID and consequences of the fact that COVID is still around. It's just we're in a weird, deluded, fever dream when it comes to coverage of these problems, or indeed linking some of the other problems that the country has got back to the pre-vaccine COVID era. But you would have thought that if we were going to take anything away from those days, what we would take away would be self-protection and community protection, protecting each other. But I don't think we have. I could be wrong. That 70% figure over in Chertsey on Saturday night or Friday night, that 70% figure is, what is that? Is that encouraging or dispiriting? There you go. I love these moments. That's the topic in a nutshell. Is 70% uplifting or dispiriting? 70% is probably not great, is it, in the context of actually trying to contain something? Then, of course, there'll be 30% of the people there who aren't putting masks on, and quite a lot of them will be, well, there's nothing wrong with me. Why would I wear a mask? Masks are to stop the spread, not to stop the ingestion, but to stop the egestion. But why? Why now? After everything we went through in the first bit of this decade, are we still a little bit or a lot resistant to solid, expert, helpful advice? Thomas Watts is here now with your headlines.
It's emerged a police officer accused of being involved in a grooming gang was allowed to retire while under investigation. A former senior detective in the Metropolitan Police has told LBC the case was brushed under the carpet. The Deputy Prime Minister David Lammy is to urge his European counterparts to modernise the ECHR. He'll warn changes to human rights law are essential to tackle illegal migration and secure the convention's future. Rachel Reeves has told MPs there was too much speculation and too many leaks ahead of the budget. The Chancellor's giving evidence to the Treasury Committee following criticism of her handling of the statement. LBC weather, brighter for most places, but the storm still causing some problems in northern Scotland where there are weather warnings in place. A high of 14 degrees.
This is LBC.
This is what award-winning customer service sounds like from Real Octopus Energy Calls.
Octopus are an absolute breath of fresh air.
Your customer service was tip-top. You know, I couldn't fault it.
People are friendly on the telephone. You can always get a problem solved.
People like yourself and all of your colleagues have done such a wonderful job.
The customer service is really good.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running.
With Lloyd's Home Insurance, there's £50,000 to be won. When you cover the glassware, no one's actually allowed to use. Or the garden shed, aka your fortress of calm. Rated excellent on Trustpilot, you can be confident with your cover when you take out a new home insurance policy and be in for a chance to win £50,000. Get a quote with Lloyd's today. Buy a new home insurance policy direct from us by the 31st of December 2025. Offer T's and C's apply. Policy terms, limits and exclusions apply.
They did it again.
flower instead of flowers on my birthday. I'm 95 minutes late, but it's hard to leave when you've shared so much. Your postcode, your gluten intolerance. Then I saw it. 25% off your first Ocado shop, plus free delivery. And I just knew I'd found the online supermarket of my dreams. Ocado, life delivered. Geographical restrictions. Min spend £60. Max saving £20. Charges and Christmas restrictions apply. New customers only. Terms at Ocado.com.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It's 10:34. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I should probably withdraw the statement that it was just Billy Bunch of Numbers and various other bonkers newspaper columnists that had an almost visceral rejection of mask wearing, because you pointed out to me that the leader of the opposition, still Kemi Badenoch, PMQ's on the way, of course, later today, coming up at about 12 o'clock. Natasha Clark will be joining us shortly before, as ever, to tee it up. But Kemi Badenoch has... here is a problem with British politics and British media in a nutshell, all right? Daily Telegraph headline, Badenoch attacks NHS order to wear face masks. Can you spot the problem with that headline? Yeah, no one's been ordered to do anything. It doesn't matter. Here we are, Daily Telegraph. Badenoch attacks NHS order to wear face masks. And then you think, well, what kind of Herbert would actually say to the most senior medics in the country that they know better? And here's your answer. Step forward, Kemi Badenoch. Kemi Badenoch has rejected calls for masks to be worn in public as flu cases rise. What? Why? On what possible planet? I mean, you know, she's never tires of telling us all the qualifications she has got, precisely none of which are medical. That is almost the emblem, isn't it, of what we're talking about? This sort of, what you call it, a sort of bone-headed combination of arrogance and ignorance. I know nothing, but I'm utterly convinced of my own brilliance, of my own genius. It's an extraordinary moment earlier this week when she was announcing some sort of grooming gang inquiry different from all the grooming gang inquiries that have gone before, and definitely different from the one that the government is currently undertaking. And she used the phrase, "We'll leave no stone unturned." And one of the best journalists in the country, Jason Farrell from Sky News, just puts his hand up, gets a question. There weren't many journalists there. By the time they came around to do another press conference later in the week, I think they'd filled the room with Tory staffers to make it look like it was busy. But Jason knows his onions. And he puts his hand up and says, just one, a bit like Columbo, actually. Just one more thing. Sajid Javid announced a grooming gang inquiry when he was Home Secretary. And he used exactly the same phrase. He said that there would be no stone unturned. That inquiry turned up two things of note. The first was that the massive majority of grooming gang cases did not involve people from ethnic minorities, although there is a disproportionate representation in some types of these crimes of men with a Pakistani heritage. And it also established that there wasn't the data available to go further into that second observation. These are just facts. These aren't opinions. This is counting. And it was a Tory inquiry that threw up those two findings. An inquiry that began with the Tory Home Secretary announcing that no stone would be left unturned. But up pops Kemi Badenoch on Monday to announce that they're going to have an inquiry that will leave no stone unturned. So Jason Farrell of Sky News says, quite reasonably, does that mean that you did leave stones unturned last time you did this? Do you know what she said in response? You wouldn't guess in a million years. She said, we're not going to build a time machine. Oh, sorry? I mean, at risk of stating the bleeding obvious, no one said you were, mate. We're not going to build a time machine. You've announced an inquiry that will leave no stone unturned. As the leader of a party that announced an inquiry that said it would leave no stone unturned, does this mean that the last time you promised to leave no stone unturned, you did actually leave lots of stones unturned, because now you're promising to do it again and leave no stones unturned? Jason Farrell put it rather better than that. But that's the point, right? And how do you respond to that? You respond to that by going, I'm sorry, I forgot. She didn't even know that Sajid Javid had said that. She's so disengaged from reality. She didn't even know that she was presumably in the cabinet or a senior minister in a government that announced exactly the same thing she'd announced this week and then claimed that they'd completed it. That's the level, that's the marriage of arrogance and ignorance that you need to then come out and say, well, I've listened to what all the doctors have got to say and I know better. I know better. It's a bit like that time her A-level results were all her teacher's fault and nothing to do with her. I know better. And here she is again talking to Sky News on specifically this issue.
I'm still slightly traumatised by all the mask wearing that we had to do during COVID. Look, you know, let's bring some common sense into this. I personally think that face coverings can be a barrier to social interaction, social cohesion. And I do worry about a mask mandate. I don't think government should be mandating anything. Let's have some common sense. I think people can make up their own minds. If you are really sick, you should be in bed. You should not be on public transport. I think that's more of a problem. But the truth is many people are contagious before they realise that they're even ill. So I'm not sure that it would work. I think it's a surprising announcement. I'm not quite sure why they've done that.
Well, why don't you ask them why they've done that? And they will tell you that masks are an effective barrier to spreading germs once you've reached the particularly high contagion levels of coughing, spluttering, sneezing. That's almost impenetrable, isn't it, that combination of arrogance and ignorance? I've got no idea where they've done it, but I think it's a bad idea. If you're going to conclude that something is a bad idea, the very least you can do is find out why it's been done. The only way you can sustain a position of complete idiocy is by not knowing why that thing you're attacking is being done. But to admit that is extraordinary. I mean, truly extraordinary. I think it's quite a surprising announcement. I'm not quite sure why they've done that. But there's a clue in that. I'm going to play it to you one more time. I think there's a clue as to what might be going on here. And it, oddly enough, ties in with that incredible comment about not building a time machine that she made on Monday when it was pointed out to her that the inquiry she was announcing had already been undertaken by her own party with exactly the same word-for-word promise to leave no stone unturned. Have another listen to this and see if you spot what I spotted.
I'm still slightly traumatised by all the mask wearing that we had to do during COVID. Look, you know, let's bring some common sense into this. I personally think that face coverings can be a barrier to social interaction, social cohesion, and I do worry about a mask mandate. I don't think government should be mandating anything. Let's have some common sense. I think people can make up their own minds. If you are really sick, you should be in bed. You should not be on public transport. I think that's more of a problem. But the truth is many people are contagious before they realise that they're even ill. So I'm not sure that it would work. I think it's a surprising announcement. I'm not quite sure why they've done that.
Traumatised by a face mask, but literally traumatised by PPE, by protective personal equipment. Face coverings, not face masks? Is that pertinent, do you think? Is she trying to make us think about niqabs and veils? I don't know. We can't possibly be in favour of face masks because we get a lot of political mileage out of attacking women who cover their faces. I don't know, but that idea of announcing it's common sense to ignore doctors. I love that. I wish she'd been in A&E in Chertsey on Friday night when that nurse came in that Susha told us about. I said, put on your face mask, there's a flu epidemic out there. And she stood up and said, actually, I'm going to follow common sense and completely ignore you, qualified expert person. I'm Kemi Badenoch and I know better. That's what we're talking about, isn't it? That's one element of the resistance that we're trying to unpick. I mean, it's probably a slightly easier sell rather than saying, what exactly explains this curious resistance to medical knowledge, which I suffer from a bit, but I have spent the morning telling you I'm an idiot. I haven't spent the morning telling you I know better than the experts. What the heck is wrong with Kemi Badenoch is possibly a slightly easier way into this. If you know someone like that, someone who thinks it's common sense to ignore the doctors. Imagine if she went to the doctors with a broken leg and they said, we're going to put you in a plaster. We're going to put you in a cast. And she said, that's just ridiculous. I've no idea why you want to do that. I mean, everybody knows that you can't run if you're wearing a cast. I mean, it's ridiculous. I'm Kemi Badenoch. I know better. Quite extraordinary. Anyway, I suppose that might make you look forward to PMQs a little bit more than you were already. Let's get back to the phones. Let's get back to people who either know that they're idiots, know that Kemi Badenoch is an idiot, or have views on why so many of us are idiots. Jessica's in Salford. Jessica, what do you think?
Hi, James. I'm actually a nurse. I'm on maternity at the moment, but I'm going in today to do a keep in touch day.
Okay.
So I will I've actually, before I even tuned in this morning, I was considering, will I be wearing a mask today? We look after vulnerable, all our patients are specifically vulnerable.
Yes.
So, and also I've got a young baby at home. I don't want to be taking that home. So I was like, whether my department have mandated that or not, I will be probably wearing one.
Even though you haven't got symptoms yourself, because it's a kind of belt and braces. What do you lose by doing it? And
exactly.
You might not gain anything, but you're definitely not going to lose anything. And you might actually protect yourself a bit from an illness that you would otherwise bring home.
Yeah. And I worked looking after purely COVID patients for pretty much 2 years. And I wore, you know, just the usual mask that you expect if I went into an area that was more high risk, so like ventilated patients with tracheostomies. We wore fit tested masks, which were more secure.
Yes.
And I didn't catch COVID once.
Wow, so, really?
Yeah. I mean, partly I'd like to say my immune system obviously probably didn't help, but, you know, they do. You can't, how people can argue that they do not work, you know.
Well, you know what your problem is.
I was cough-spluttered over everything, and with a mask and other PPE, but, you know, I did not catch it.
Do you know what your problem is?
Go on.
You got no common sense.
Probably, yeah.
Why on earth would you be listening to your colleagues in the hospital instead of listening to Kemi Badenoch, who once worked in New Look?
I know. I think it's just intrinsically, people don't want to inconvenience themselves, and it's selfish, so they will find any rhetoric that gives them the opportunity to doesn't inconvenience themselves. So by her saying this, I think it's really dangerous, because a lot of people will go, well, Kemi said this, so then it justifies it for me.
I think I can reassure you on that. I can't quite conceive of anybody with a fully functioning cerebral cortex who would say to themselves, well, Kemi Badenoch said that, so I'm going to take it seriously. I could be wrong, but on this occasion, I don't actually think that I am. I mean, the one thing she said about you might be contagious before you've got symptoms, you could probably chalk that up as fair comment. But the idea that because some people might be contagious before they've got symptoms, people who've got symptoms shouldn't wear masks is a leap of such extraordinary stupidity that you could probably see it from space.
Oh, it's absolutely, I just think it's, I can't even think of the word to say, express how ridiculous the comments are.
And dangerous as well, of course.
Yes, very, really dangerous. Like, what is wearing a mask really going to do apart from slightly inconvenience you? I've worn them for 7 hours straight, fit tested masks, where you can't take them off at all and they're uncomfortable. That is inconvenient, but would I not do it? Would I do it again if I needed to? Absolutely. Like, I just, oh.
No, I get it. I can hear it in your voice. I can hear it in your voice. I hope today goes well. I hope the little getting to know you session is all the things
it's nice to see the patients. It's lovely to see my patients. And because they're all vulnerable, they were isolating beforehand. They'll all probably be isolating again now because they are so vulnerable. And they'll probably all be wearing masks to protect themselves.
Yes, because it's a horrible strain. There's a lot of horrible flu around. I know two teenage boys who've been hospitalised having contracted flu recently. One of them wasn't hospitalised specifically for flu, but the infection has moved. He ended up with sinusitis, and then it moved into his brain. And we're all very, very, very closely watching his progress and praying for him, because we know him from Catholic school. And another boy who is just absolutely destroyed by it ended up on a drip this weekend. And so why would you not do everything you possibly can to prevent the spread? Answer, I'm Kemi Badenoch and I know better.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
We cannot have groups of random, bored, culturally incompatible men wandering around towns and villages of places unfortunate enough to be burdened with this. At a minimum, the rule has to be, you cannot leave the facility you're being fed and watered in until we know who you are or until your claim has been processed. Otherwise, the status quo carries on with results being like this.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
If I need an eye test, I don't go to Specsavers.
One thing you won't see at Specsavers is me.
Do I go?
Yes!
I mean, no. Me, I don't go to Specsavers. Nor you, eh, Spike?
Should have gone to Specsavers. Nah.
Hi, Specsavers. Here for your eye test.
They come to me instead.
Come in.
Kettle's on.
Oh, thank you.
If you can't go to Specsavers unaccompanied, we could come to you. See if you're eligible at specsavers.co.uk/home visits.
They did it again. Flour instead of flowers. On my birthday. I'm 95 minutes late, but it's hard to leave when you've shared so much. Your postcode, your gluten intolerance. Then I saw it. 25% off your first Ocado shop, plus free delivery. And I just knew I'd found the online supermarket of my dreams. Ocado, life delivered. Geographical restrictions. Min spend £60. Max saving £20. Charges and Christmas restrictions apply. New customers only. Terms at Ocado.com.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
At Fidelity, we've been helping our customers plan for their retirement for nearly 20 years. From understanding how much you'll need, to combining multiple pensions, we offer expert insights, excellent service, and even financial advice, so you can feel confidently invested in your future. For pensions, advice or investment accounts, be invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Transferring is not right for everyone. Terms apply.
You weren't supposed to burn the potatoes or invite everyone round at two. We said three. You weren't supposed to fall asleep on the sofa or ask me to marry you. And you weren't supposed to be here. But you are. Thanks to the best gift you ever got. And mine is still having you.
When you donate to the British Heart Foundation, you give a gift that keeps on living. Search BHF today and help us fund life-saving research.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060973.
It is 10 minutes to 11. And, do you know, speaking to that nurse a moment ago, it reminded me of a story that in some ways is more important than the story we're talking about today. I mean, it's not actually a medical story exactly, but in terms of how many bells it rings in your brain, it might be a bigger story currently, unless you are ill, unless you are struggling, unless you have got legacies from the era when we were mostly all wearing masks that are ringing very, very resonant today. This story here is one of those stories that leaves me wondering why we aren't manning the barricades. £10.9 billion. Let's say 11 for the sake of money, all right, for the sake of argument. It's in a headline that also includes the word COVID. What do you think the rest of the headline says? COVID scheme fraud hit almost £11 billion. But much of it is beyond recovery. This is a report published yesterday by the COVID Counter Fraud Commissioner. Whew. And of course, if you were to read this in a newspaper, it would not be something that was being hung around the neck of the politicians that were in charge at the time. It'll be reported as almost an act of God. Oh my goodness, whoops-a-daisy, we lost 11 billion quid. Not the people in charge were such idiots and incompetent and borderline corrupt that they actually allowed £11 billion worth of our money to be stolen. £5 billion of it went through the, employment support schemes set up by the previous Conservative government. Paragraph 3 of the BBC's coverage, not in any headlines in any newspapers I've seen this morning, suffered £5 billion worth of the fraud. That's the employment support schemes that were set up inadequately and incompetently. They've recovered about £1.8 billion. Fair play, you know, it's better than a kick in the teeth, but much of the shortfall is now beyond recovery. They don't know how much will be recovered in total, but who do you think is going to be held responsible for £11 billion worth of losses to the public purse? Who do you think? In fact, would anybody like to check whether this story is receiving more or less coverage than Rachel Reeves winning a chess competition as a young girl and being accused of lying about winning a chess competition as a national chess competition as a young girl? Would anyone like to check whether £11 billion worth of fraud visited upon this country by Tory government incompetence received more or less coverage in Tory-supporting media than Rachel Reeves's rental agents telling her that they would fill in a form she needed to fill in so she didn't need to worry about it, therefore she didn't fill it in? And speaking of Rachel Reeves, I wonder how much coverage this story is going to get. It's a headline in the Times on the business pages. It's the only place I've seen it. Reeves has, quotes, one city's confidence. Market confidence in Sir Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves has gained momentum since the summer, prompting experts to proclaim the end of the UK's risk premium, which could save taxpayers billions of pounds. Now, for the avoidance of doubt, if you come from the left, then the further to the left you are, the more troubled you will be by the idea of a Labour government prioritising the bond markets and bankers' feelings over the welfare of the population. The challenge Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves have set themselves is to try to keep both plates spinning, to try to address both constituencies. The sharp increase in UK government borrowing costs relative to peers in the G7 since Labour won the general election has partially unwound since the Chancellor again stressed her commitment to keeping to her fiscal rules. So Rachel Reeves wins the confidence of the city, a story that emerges in the context of pretty much everybody on a certain political bandwagon claiming that she is, we saw, didn't we, in Budget Week, how they moved effortlessly from claiming that she'd ruined the economy to claiming that she hadn't ruined the economy and that she was in trouble for not ruining the economy. But just little illustration of how the media works for you. 10:55 is the time, because I think it applies to masks as well. I think there'll be a Venn diagram here. For example, kind of people who claim that they're passionately opposed to face coverings, up to and including medical masks, are the kind of people that wear balaclava helmets when they're painting roundabouts in the middle of the night. What's that about? When do you cover your face? To protect other people from a potentially hideous illness? No. The only time I ever cover my face is when I'm climbing up lampposts outside your house to stick tatty old flags you don't want on the street furniture. So I'm not opposed to face coverings, just not for medical reasons. I only wear them when I'm painting roundabouts. Anyone else hear a bit of George Formby in the background when I'm painting roundabouts? Jenny's in St. Albans. Jenny, what made you pick up the phone, if you can remember?
Oh, I can remember, but I mean, some of it's been a little bit covered already. But
don't worry about that, Jenny. Don't worry. I'll fill your boots.
Okay. Well, I'm just to try and draw a few threads together. You just mentioned about Venn diagrams. The reason that I called in was because I felt that around the time of the pandemic, there was this kind of evil trinity, if you like, which was people who were mask skeptics, people who were Brexiters, and people who had, very emotional, sort of, they're all trying to inject us with killer molecules, attitudes towards vaccines.
Yes.
And, you know, the
absolute head cases. Just to be clear, you're describing people who tick all three of those boxes. You're not suggesting that all Brexiters are, for example, frightened of phone masks.
No, I'm not. But I'm suggesting that, you know, there's a big overlap in the Venn diagram between those three
circles. Yes, I agree.
Right? And you also mentioned Kemi Badenoch, and if you hadn't, then I would have said something about her, because what she said, this kind of appeal to common sense, it's almost like a dog whistle for people like that. It's the kind of Michael Gove, we're not interested in listening to experts anymore, which is why we ended up coming out of the EU, and the day after the vote, people say, well,
what's that about?
I didn't mean it. Yeah. I just wanted to sort of tell them that I don't want to be pushed around and I don't want to be told what to do. And I think people's concept of, I don't want to wear a mask because it makes me look like a chump, it makes me look like someone who's doing what they're told, and, you know, people using the expression sheeple, is similar to people's attitude towards this kind of very, very nebulous concept of sovereignty. Nobody can actually define it or what it means. It's more just it exists on a very, very emotional level, and I think...
And that's what this appears. This is a brilliant analysis.
Invoking common sense is a dog whistle for those people who are sort of, well,
I know
better. I don't care about your bits of paper. I've got a PhD from the University of Life.
I'd also, if we were to extend the Venn diagram slightly, they're probably more likely to be out painting roundabouts at the weekend than the rest of us are. Can I ask what you do for a living, or what your sort of perspective on this is?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a doctor, and I worked in an accident emergency during the pandemic.
Oh, Lord, I'm not laughing at what you did during the pandemic. I'm just laughing at the idea that a doctor, somehow in our ludicrous Brexit Britain, is set up in opposition to the leader of the Conservative Party when it comes to what we should do in the context of potential health crises. Who are you going to listen to?
Another thing about what...
I told you to fill your boots, Jenny. You've taken me very literally. I'm enjoying this.
Sorry, carry on. I'll clear off and let someone else have a say if you want. But another thing is, I mean, how utterly, utterly ridiculous to use a word like traumatised about having to wear a mask. You know, I mean, I'm just going to mention two things, okay? I worked in accident emergency during the pandemic, and I can genuinely say I do feel slightly traumatised by some of the experiences I had. I had to telephone people and tell them that their spouse of, you know, nearly 50 years wasn't going to make it through the weekend, and no, they couldn't come in and see them because of the restrictions. And I still struggle, actually, with thinking about those conversations that I had to have. And, you know, there was an immense amount of trauma that was suffered by the British public during the pandemic for all sorts of reasons. Traumatised is not being able to arrange a funeral for your mother, not being able to hold her hand while she's dying because she's dying of COVID. It's not wearing a mask for other people's benefit.
I was so busy finding her ridiculous that I forgot to find her disgusting.
Well, it is disgusting. I think it's disgusting. You and I have spoken once before, and this is about the coronation, and actually you put it on YouTube, so I think you liked my call then. But one of the reasons I've been less active on LBC is because in the intervening 2 years, I've had a high-risk cancer, which I was treated for with 12 months of treatment, including chemotherapy, surgery, radiotherapy, the works. I'm not going to say what it was, and I don't want to frighten anybody, but there was a paper that was published in a very respected medical journal. I think it was Nature. It may have been The Lancet at the end of June or July.
Yes.
Which basically said that the type of cancer I got, if you're treated for primary cancer, which is cancer that hasn't spread beyond the organ it originated in, catching COVID or catching flu can actually activate dormant cancer cells in the lungs and give you incurable disease. So I'm terrified.
Of course you are.
I've caught COVID. I've had COVID 3 times, actually. I had it once right at the beginning of the pandemic. I had once after the vaccines. And I had it once earlier this year, actually, in the spring. But, you know, I'm genuinely worried about... I used to catch things occasionally. And flu is really nasty. And people don't realise how nasty it is.
It's really horrible.
And it's really important to protect other people who are more vulnerable, who are more likely to suffer sort of complications and, you know, really serious adverse consequences because of flu. We can't always see from looking at people, you know, what their state of health is. And there are an awful lot of people going around who are particularly vulnerable to being really laid low and knocked back by a nasty bout of flu. It's just a no-brainer to wear a mask. It protects other people. And I really would urge anybody who's got symptoms, particularly if they've got fever, flu symptoms, just stay away from other people. And for goodness sake, wear a mask and limit contact.
Thank you. I mean, thank you for everything, but thank you for this call. When I say everything, I mean what you did during the pandemic and the reminder of what traumatic experiences involve in the real world, as opposed to the Badenoch universe, where not even having to, or simply wearing a mask in order to protect other people from hideous illness is somehow traumatized. Isn't she one of the people that uses the word snowflake as a pejorative, or that talks about other people not being tough enough, traumatized by a face mask? Jenny, thank you, and I hope you're recovery continues. I really do. I covered an awful lot of ground, but you covered it in quite spectacularly expert fashion. So thank you again. It's 11:02.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, LBC has been told a former Metropolitan Police officer was accused of being part of a grooming gang, but the case was brushed under the carpet. Two women who grew up in Care made allegations against the custody sergeant in 2012, but it was dropped because of a lack of evidence. We can now reveal he was allowed to retire while under investigation. A former detective, whose voice we've changed, believes there was a cover-up.
I would have gone to his house and arrested him. I would have searched everything, seized all his electronics, brought him in, interviewed him, and he would have been released on bail. There's no way he, a month later, should have been just allowed to retire.
The Met says it's reviewing the case and has encouraged anyone with information to come forward. You can see more on the LBC app. Britain has urged its allies to help reform the European Convention on Human Rights. Ministers say the future of the ECHR is at risk without changes to make it easier to deport illegal migrants. LBC's political editor Natasha Clark has more.
The Deputy Prime Minister David Lammy's in Strasbourg today for a Council of Europe summit where there will be international talks on modernising the interpretation of international laws. Nine member states, including Italy and Denmark, signed a letter back in May calling for the scope of the ECHR to be limited. But critics of the government's asylum changes argue the Prime Minister should not be diluting vital protections and that he's pandering to the right.
Rachel Reeves has told MPs there were too many leaks ahead of the budget. The Chancellor's described the disclosures as unacceptable and says a security review is underway. Ms Reeves has been giving evidence to the Treasury Committee.
The budget had too much speculation, there were too many leaks, and much of that, those leaks and speculation were inaccurate, very damaging, as well as the IT security issues.
She's again insisted freezing tax thresholds did not amount to a breach of the Labour manifesto. The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy's, told LBC that ministers are keeping a very close eye on Australia's social media ban. But she's indicated the UK has no plans to impose similar restrictions.
We heard from over 14,000 young people in this country. They were really concerned that if you introduced a blanket ban, it might push young people into other parts of the internet.
Under-16s in Australia have spent their first day without platforms, including TikTok and Instagram. And Police Scotland has confirmed the M74 has reopened after a number of lorries were blown over. The main motorway linking England and Scotland was shut near Abington in South Lanarkshire for more than 12 hours. Weather warnings for Storm Bram are still in place across northern Scotland. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 96.50. That's up 8 points. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 14. LBC weather brighter for most places today, but still quite blustery with outbreaks of heavy rain in Scotland. A high of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 6 minutes after 11 and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Who do you think has blamed Brexit for, and I'm going to quote here, all that is going wrong now? Was it A, Nigel Farage, B, Kemi Badenoch, or C, Jacob Rees-Mogg? Oh, you've got to love Moggy. Was it A, Nigel Farage, B, Kemi Badenoch, or C, Jacob Rees-Mogg? Who has, in the last 24 hours, blamed Brexit, or described Brexit, as part of all that is going wrong now and has gone wrong in the past? Which one of those characters do you think has had a very unexpected and uncharacteristic rush of blood to the head? I shall hopefully remember to tell you before 12 o'clock today, when, of course, PMQs will be upon us. A couple of other things that you should be aware of. Andy Hughes will be joining us after PMQs with this extraordinary story that you've heard in the news bulletins today with regard to a police officer under investigation for essentially operating a child sex abuse ring or a grooming gang. but being permitted to retire as the investigation listen, just trust me, it's an incredible story, and Andy's got much more detail than we can contain within a single news bulletin, and he will be with us at about 12:30 today. And then at 12:45, we'll return, and I wish we didn't have to, but we do, to the Windrush scandal, something else, of course, presided over by the Conservative government, and have a look at the lack of legal assistance that many of the victims of that appalling, or those appalling miscarriages of justice are still not getting, the lack of legal assistance that is still in place. It's extraordinary how the spotlight of human concern and attention moves, isn't it? It's partly our fault, it's partly the media's fault, but there's something else going on there as well. There's human nature involved. Donald Trump doing what he's doing now with regard to Ukraine would no way near get away with it if he'd been doing it in the early days of that conflict, when the passionate support for Ukraine was off the charts, uniting almost every political constituency in this country. You know, even Boris Johnson looked good for a while with his support for Ukraine, as long as you forgot about all the parties he attended with former members of the KGB. And, of course, I'm with Vladimir Putin on that. There's no such thing as a former member of the KGB. But here is a story that speaks to something that we have never really talked about on the programme before. And it's something that worries me slightly. The problem with being worried by this is, it's not really my place. But you know this curious fashion to fetishise strict teachers? The way in which, and you'll be thinking of, I imagine, one in particular who styles herself as the strictest teacher in the country, or the strictest head teacher in the country. I think that's really weird, right? And I think it's really weird because it's not something that we should be proud of. This Victorian notion that children should be treated like miscreants, or they should be treated as if they're guilty until they can prove themselves innocent, or that they should be treated with lots and lots of sticks and no carrots. Regimentation, I think, is the word that I'm looking for. Regimentation in school, like epic strictness. And the reason why I'm not sure it's my place to say some of the things that I'm about to say is because it can produce results. So a cowed child can be a more productive child. A frightened child can work harder than an unfrightened child. How do I know? I think I was that child. It's specific to teachers rather than a school ethos. I'm very lucky to have a couple of teachers who were just what you might describe as master craftsmen. They weren't necessarily disciplinarians. I had violent teachers. That's not what we're going to be talking about today. But some teachers possessed an extraordinary gift to get the best out of you, because you were either frightened of the consequences or frightened of disappointing them. So I think strictness in school can enhance a pupil's performance while damaging them as people. And this is what I find most fascinating about a story today describing a London academy instilling a climate of fear among pupils, with a drive for academic success likely to have harmed vulnerable children, particularly those with special needs. This according to an investigation led by one of the country's foremost experts in children's services. And they describe measures that were, quotes, designed to humiliate pupils, shouting at them, isolating them in corridors as part of a harsh and damaging disciplinary culture. But if the school then delivers wonderful A-levels, wonderful results, if it gets children into top universities, you can just about imagine how some of these characters, some of these teachers, I've always felt that adults who brutalise children should be pilloried and condemned, not championed and celebrated. As Ash points out, why don't we venerate Britain's most caring head teacher instead of Britain's strictest head teacher? But if you get the results, and particularly, isn't it amazing how many paths of awfulness lead back to Michael Gove's time in politics? Don't worry, he's back in journalism now, editing a magazine that's just published a piece claiming that everybody shared Nigel Farage's views about Adolf Hitler being right when when they were at school, at public school in the 1970s. More on that later this hour, if I remember. But the relationship between strictness and performance is a heck of a lot more complicated than we like to acknowledge. So if this school were not as strict, it's called Mossbourne Victoria Park Academy, part of a chain of academies, I think. And at this line here, academic excellence that traumatises some pupils is not true excellence. Cuts to the very, very heart of what I'm clumsily trying to describe to you. Because they will point at the academic excellence and claim that that excuses the trauma. And people, of course, who can be traumatised by face masks, like Kemi Badenoch, will very much come down on the side of the uber-strict or ultra-strict schools, ultra-strict teachers. And I'll tell you what my problem is. My problem is that you won't know what's happened to those kids until long after they've left the exam hall and long after they've left the school. I mean, you might have an inkling of damage that's being done because it is usually, and again, I speak with some experience, it is usually the same children receiving the worst punishments. And whether that's down to neurodiversity or something else, I do not know. It will differ according to circumstance. But a really disciplinarian system that is always punishing the same relatively small number of people doesn't seem to me to be fit for purpose, because it's not addressing the question of why the same relatively small number of people keep getting into trouble. And then, of course, people who aren't even getting into trouble are being traumatized because they're being shouted at in corridors, because they're watching other people being humiliated. They are suffering strictness. And that's what I want to talk about. Now, don't worry, this isn't a radio program where we now invite somebody who revels in the self-appointed title strictest this or strictest that. I want to talk to you. And I don't want to talk to you about what you would describe as obvious abuse. So this isn't about teachers that hit you, or teachers that broke the law, or teachers that did things we would today find repellent, even if we found them slightly less repellent in the 1970s or the 1980s. This is about simple strictness. What a teacher doing it would describe as discipline, and probably even try to argue was good for us. And if you were to measure that exclusively by exam results, they might have a case. I mean, you've got two schools, right? Head teacher comes in, or the same school in two periods. It's not performing well. Head teacher comes in. Nothing else changes. They just become measurably and obviously, quotes, stricter, end quotes. And the exam results go up. Who is going to say this is really bad? Well, the answer in this case is some of the parents at this particular school who have called for an investigation into the school's culture and have described themselves now as being relieved at its findings and calling for a change of leadership, or for the leadership to change course. Either would do. The Department of Education has described the findings as serious and deeply concerning. Under Michael Gove, this wouldn't be a story, because the exam results would matter immeasurably and infinitely more than the trauma or difficulties being suffered by these children. And you can probably tell from my voice that I have room here for manoeuvre, because I spent years thinking that sparing the rod spoiled the child. I know you will find this hard to believe, but I've told you often enough, you must know by now that it's true. I was an advocate of corporate punishment on the grounds that A, it didn't do me any harm, and B, it focused my mind and made me a better pupil. Actual corporate punishment, actual physical violence inflicted upon 10, 11, 12-year-old boys by a grown man with a specially designed implement. And I sat here when I started this job, convinced in my own mind that this was a good, that level of strictness was a good thing. I'm mentioning that only as an exemplar and an extremity, because as I say, we're not talking about physical violence. That's no longer permitted, it's no longer legal, it's no longer allowed. And on a personal level, at least, I no longer labour under the ludicrous delusion that it did me good, or that it wasn't a hideous infringement of my my rights, my humanity, and a deeply damaging experience for everybody who ever went through it, especially the ones who insisted it didn't do them any harm, because we are the ones who have worked hardest to bury the pain and bury the trauma and pretend that we were absolutely fine, despite being brutalized by the only adults on the planet that we were in a position to trust at the time. Strictness and the damage it does is what I want you to talk to me about. It's tricky, right? But shouting. Shouting can be as traumatic as violence. So, you know, especially if you're right up in someone's face, absolutely bellowing. But anything that makes you jump is bad for you. Anything that makes you, oh, crikey, my heart's gone. So what I want you to do, if you can, and talk about either yourself or your child, what does a climate of fear do to you when you're at school? You can go back as far as you want, but I don't want actual abuse, because I hope nobody needs that picture painting. But what does a climate of fear do to a child at school? If they are frightened almost all the time, even, and I think perhaps especially the kids who are not routinely getting into trouble. What does a climate of fear? Tell me it's a good thing if you want. By all means, tell me you wouldn't be the man you are today if it hadn't been for the climate of fear that you were educated in. But you can tell where my instincts take me. My instincts take me towards a place where this does a hell of a lot of harm, invisible harm, even as it does visible good. So the visible good will be the exam results. All of these kids are bloody terrified, but look at their A-levels. Well, I can look at their A-levels, and I can accept that they're probably higher than they would be if the school was run differently. But what other damage is being done? What are the invisible consequences of, I love this phrase, a climate of fear in a school? And you know the answer to this, even if you don't realise that you know, because you're thinking about it now and you're going, oh, flipping heck, that's why I'm nervous in those sort of circumstances. That's why I'm frightened of this. That's why things went so weird when I left school. What does a climate of fear do to a child at school? 03-45-60-60-973.
LBC.
There's an old Thai saying that roughly translates as, the family who takes the internet on holiday can locate a less crowded beach. Particularly handy, my friend, if it's peak mating season for nippy little crabs. Pack the internet with an eSIM from Aerolo. That's A-I-R-A-L-O.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Waitrose presents £10 Fine Wines.
A special toast to Alice, finally, home for Christmas.
Oh, yeah, welcome home.
Starring Prince Alexander Cremant de Loire, a balance of pear and fresh green apple. Montesillo Rioja Reserva, with notes of forest fruits and spices. And special guest, Carte de Lune Chambacon Lune, bursting with apple blossom and citrus peel.
This is the wine I was telling you about. From
French Vineyard, I know.
Waitrose, the home of food lovers.
Selected items and stores subject to availability. Prices may vary in Channel Islands at the Waitrose and Partners and Concessions.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It is 11:21. It's an extraordinary phrase to appear in a description of a school in 2025, but it's probably more widespread than we realise. Academy criticised in report over its, quotes, climate of fear, end quotes. And leaving aside the obvious impacts of actual violence and, you know, criminal or illegal abuse, I just wonder what a climate of fear does to a child, even as they possibly secure better exam results than they would have done in a climate of kindness and calm. I'm not sure that's true, by the way. I don't think that's a given. I don't think it's a no-brainer by any stretch of the imagination, but that would be the defence, that would be the rationale from the advocates of a climate of fear. Never mind the nastiness,
feel the quality of the results. 22 minutes after 11 is the time. Christina is in Wimbledon. Christina, what made you pick up the phone?
I picked up the phone because what I'm going through with my daughter right now is exactly what I just heard on LBC, and I thought I should explain what a climate of fear does to a child. Moving from reception to year one in September, a number of the kids, obviously I started with seeing it with my child, she started to chew all her clothes and her hair. And then when I started looking into this, I was trying to find out what was going on. So I spoke to other parents and to the teacher. It's the transition from moving freely in reception to now having to sit at a desk at some schools, not all, and it's quite hard for the children, so they're getting told off, or they're told to keep still. And so obviously they're getting anxiety and stress, and they're going to things that are quite easy for them to do. If they're, you know, not able to bounce their legs because they're moving too much and getting told off, they're chewing their hair. And the wetting the bed, because in some strict places, the climate is fear, like where...
It's very young, year one is very young to be.
She's five, and it's year one, yes.
Okay. That's very young, isn't it, to be getting that level of discipline? Did you know that when you chose the school?
No, I didn't know anything about... I did hear that, you know, you know, when they move to year one, it might be a bit stricter. They'll have less of the free movement, but I didn't know none of it. Obviously, I had to go through this to see that I don't want this for my other child who is three. So I found a new school with freer movement, and that's where we're going.
So it's a simple kind of, I mean, I keep saying Victorian. I don't know if that's the right word to use, but it is a sit still, do as you're told. Regimented is the best word to use, isn't it? It's one size fits all. If get in line or get in trouble.
Exactly. And I know from experience, when I was younger, you know, if I was late for a moment at break time because I would drop my younger sister to her teacher because she was always upset, I would be sent to the headmistress every day. And I already know what damage that's done to me. I was like, I'm not keeping my children here. I'm going to find somewhere where they can be freer to move. And I found that.
Yeah, and so you don't want them to be feral or to be ill-disciplined or to be, you know, uncontrolled. You just recognise that there are two extremes and the best place to be is going to be between them. And it's odd, isn't it, how some of the public discourse has moved back towards the notion of brutalising a child being good for them. And listen, I will get messages. I've had some messages from people who tell me that their children are at the school that is the subject of this investigation, and they contrast. Some are negative and some are positive. And I worry, and I say this with great love and concern, that just because your teenagers are being very well-mannered and polite now is not proof that they're not suffering from the consequences of being educated in a climate of fear. You don't need me to draw you a map, but if you are behaving in a certain way because you have been inculcated in a climate of fear, then A, it's not actually the authentic you, and B, goodness knows what you're tamping down or storing up for the future. I hope nothing, don't get me wrong, but I wouldn't read too much into the fact that you don't think your child has been negatively affected by what an independent inquiry has found to be a climate of fear. It could well be, I'm just saying, it's not guaranteed, it's not copper-bottomed. Thank you, Christina. Carla is in Cobham. Carla, what would you like to say?
Oh, hi. Thank you for listening to me. I was just, this is such a big topic for me, it actually makes my blood boil.
Yes.
I'm a children's occupational therapist. I've been in many, many schools over the last 16 years. And I also have two children. One is a 17-year-old girl and the other is a 14-year-old boy.
Okay.
And I've had to move them out of the traditional system into a more non-traditional international environment.
Why? Tell me why, yeah.
Well, I just saw the light going out in my children. You know, these are kids who can do well academically, can play sports.
Yes.
And they were being told off. They were being reprimanded for talking twice in the same lesson when they'd been told to keep quiet. They were being asked to sit still. They didn't have a voice. They weren't seen. And their friends, too. I mean, you know, luckily we could move them. I also found them to be in a stress response. very fatigued, and I see that in a lot of children. So a lot.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I have to advocate for people listening who don't have your expertise in the field of occupational therapy, and they will be thinking, but of course children have to sit still and be quiet in class.
Yeah.
Because if every child didn't sit still and be quiet, no child would ever learn anything.
Yeah, but would you sit still all day in everything that you're doing at work? You need to be able to stand up and move. You need to be able to share ideas. The educational environment that my kids are in now has made them flourish, but they're not reprimanded and they have a voice.
I think what I was thinking was, not so much, because I mean, there will be people who can recall their own school days and are adamant that they didn't need to wander around or move. Mm-hmm. But that's a bit moot, because what I'm thinking about is the way in which a child is told to sit still and what happens to them if they don't stroke can't. That's what a climate of fear is. It's not so much having an expectation of stillness. It's about what happens to you if you breach that expectation.
Well, I can give you an idea.
Yes.
In that previous school, by the time my children got home, I would have been emailed with a pink slip or a good slip. And if they'd done anything extraordinary, I would have had a green information slip. And if they'd dared to think or do anything that wasn't, and these are not things that are unsafe, obviously, or, you know, terrible behavior things. These are just standard children behaviors. If they dared do anything, I would have already received the equivalent of a pink slip. So by the time they got home, they knew I would know how they'd behaved. They knew they had that pressure.
That's a climate of fear. I mean, the BBC carries another report on two other secondary schools from a part of the same organization, and it describes frequent detentions for minor issues, a lack of flexibility for pupils with additional needs, and poor communication from staff. It feels like my school days. It feels like all powerful masters who, if you were lucky, they didn't abuse the responsibilities and powers that they had, but if you were unlucky, they did. And you know, the insecure ones or the slightly less intelligent ones were the ones that were most likely to think that they had unfettered or undiluted power over relatively small, some cases very small children.
Yes, definitely. And there's a very big difference between punishing and being strict.
And encouraging or helping.
Scaffolding. If you know, each child's got their own potential. And, you know, a star does not mean you've got a happy child. I won't say who, but I had a sir a leading professional who represents the educational world in England say to me, a child who does well is happy. And I just wanted to scream at him and say, no, a happy child does well. How could you not know that?
I mean, that's part of what I was just nudging or gently suggesting before you came on about just the simple fact that your child is currently ticking all the boxes and apparently flourishing in what independent advisors or independent investigators are describing as a climate of fear isn't necessarily proof that your child isn't suffering any harm. They're doing well, therefore they must be happy. I know a lot of kids who did extremely well at school who were not happy at all. I did pretty well at school before I got expelled. When I wasn't very happy at all in most elements of my education. I don't think that a kid doing well is proof that a kid, quite the opposite. And I do think that a happy kid will generally do well. Thank you for that, Carla. It is 11:31. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I'll read some of the messages from sort of other side of the argument after the very latest headlines with Thomas Watts.
It emerged a police officer accused of being involved in a grooming gang in London was allowed to retire while still being investigated. A former detective has told LBC they believe the allegations were brushed under the carpet. The Prime Minister has warned changes to human rights law are needed to halt the rise of far-right populists. Britain is using a summit to push for reforms to the interpretation of the ECHR to help tackle illegal migration. Rachel Reeves has told MPs there was too much speculation and too many leaks ahead of the budget. The Chancellor, who's been giving evidence to the Treasury Committee, says a security review is underway. LBC weather, brighter for most places today, but the storm still leaving some blustery conditions with heavy rain in Scotland. High of 14 degrees.
This is LBC.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming,
heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia, and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
At Fidelity, we've been helping our customers plan for their retirements for nearly 20 years. From understanding how much you'll need, to combining multiple pensions, we offer expert insights, excellent service, and even financial advice, so you can feel confidently invested in your future. For pensions, advice, or investment accounts, be invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Transferring is not right for everyone. Terms apply.
It's the explosive number one bestseller that's been making headlines. Entitled, the jaw-dropping book on the former Duke of York. Meticulously researched, Entitled reveals claims of a spoilt prince unable to connect and an insecure duchess desperate for attention. Described as the most devastating royal biography ever written. Get the book that everyone will be talking about this Christmas. Entitled by Andrew Loney. Available now.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, drop up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with...
Think, though the four trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 11:34. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. My sons are at this school and do not exist in a climate of fear. They have wonderful, committed teachers who give them an amazing education, build their confidence and give them real ambition for what they can achieve. They feel very, very safe. Stop peddling this nonsense. Yes, there are high expectations for behaviour, but they accept that and are thriving. You are driving a really negative narrative and you know nothing about the school or what it's like to be there. It's incredibly damaging for our local community. And that texter follows it up a few minutes later with three words in capital letters. They are happy. I'm not. I'm driving a negative narrative. I'm reporting on an independent investigation called for by parents at the school into what the investigator has concluded is a climate of fear. And I'm looking at other stories from the same chain that appear elsewhere in the UK media, including one that appears under the headline, School Punished My Child Because I Missed Her Parents' Evening. This is a story of several parents of pupils at two secondary schools in Essex saying their children have been left anxious, unsupported and in some cases unsafe since the schools were taken over by the Hackney-based Mossbourne Federation earlier this year. So I can take both of these parents, all of these parents equally, but the only one telling me that I should shut up and stop talking about the other parents is the person using capital letters to describe how happy their children are. And that is just my illustration of concern, particularly concern about that phrase there. Where is it? They have wonderful communities. Yeah, there are high expectations for behaviour. That's the same thing as a culture of fear. What happens if they don't meet those high expectations? What are those high expectations? What are the high expectations of behaviour? And what happens if you don't meet them? And just because your children are meeting them doesn't mean that they're not victims of a climate of fear. I hope they're not. I hope the number of children who are directly and negatively affected by what this investigator has found is tiny or negligible. Seems unlikely, given the clamour of parents, 150 pupils withdrawn from the two secondary schools that we were just alluding to since this organisation took over. Others, of course, have kept them enrolled and said that they were struggling to get their concerns addressed. But there you go, I've read out those words word for word, and I'm just left wondering exactly what are the high expectations for behaviour and what happens when you don't meet them. And of course, it's quite an easy way to find out. I could read the investigation and be accused of not knowing what goes on in the school while reading an investigation into what goes on in the school undertaken by one of the country's leading experts in this field. But hey-ho. Benjamin's in Bristol. Benjamin, what made you pick up the phone?
I used to be a teacher, and have you ever heard of the Ready to Learn policy?
The what?
The Ready to Learn policy.
I don't know that I have, but tell me what it is.
Basically, it's carried out in lots of schools. About 10 years ago, it came in, and it's sort of one warning, then the second warning you're out of the classroom. But it's for simple things like just talking out of place, maybe stood up.
Okay.
And 10 years later, the research is showing that it's actually stifled creativity. Children are a bit worried about putting their hands up. Now they don't go down avenues that they would have otherwise gone down.
I'm hardly surprised by that, and I suspect you probably aren't either.
No, I mean, my basic thing, when you teach a child to walk, okay, a baby to walk, you don't tell them off of the things they've done wrong. You celebrate the successes along the way. And at some point in a classroom, that changes. And obviously, that you've got to be quiet at some point, okay, and you've got to follow some rules so some learning can get done.
Yes.
But when you look at the budgets for inclusion and for bad behaviour being in the hundreds of thousands within schools, sending people out, and then you look at the celebration budgets, which are sometimes teachers buying sweets and rewarding. It's no wonder. Teachers like it. Teachers like it. It's easy. 1-2 warning, you're out. Okay.
Some teachers like it. You clearly didn't.
Yeah. No, I didn't. I didn't. But I mean, a lot of people teach. And what's really sad is some children like it as well, because they feel, I'm going to go completely against some of the stuff you said, they do feel safer.
You say that's a sad thing. It's from their point of view, it isn't. I got a really good message here saying, I went to school in Hackney and I recall my lessons constantly. I'm against creating a climate of fear, but I went to school in Hackney and I recall my lessons constantly being disrupted by the quotes, naughty kids, end quotes, who often made teachers cry. It stopped me learning completely in some cases. And again, there are two extremes, and you can understand why people want to move away from that extreme.
Yep.
Can't you?
Yeah. But I mean, it goes back to that celebration. If you look at how we help children move forward, it is stick most of the time in schools.
And what do we think it does? I mean, stifling creativity is a time. I know what you mean, but it's a bit nebulous.
Yeah, I mean, so you might not want to express your feelings in a piece of art, and you might not want to challenge it. The way people look at that, and when you're designing, there's certain things you do. You've got to get up quick. You've got to get about the classroom, and even in minuscule bits like that, it does. You just go, okay, I'll just do this instead.
So the word I keep reaching for is regimented. And that's what you mean when you say it actually suits some children, or some children like it. So good reasons to like it would be, well, it's a lot less disrupted and disruptive than the alternative that I have experience of. But I quite like not having to think for myself. I quite like what being told what to do. I quite like having high expectations of my behaviour.
Yeah.
And stuff the kids who don't is the subtext here.
Well, I mean, it's what you're looking to get out of it as well. If you're looking to build leaders, build strong people, they need to be able to lead.
You can't innovate if you're terrified you're going to get things wrong.
No. You're selling them short.
You can't create, you can't innovate, you can't be original, you can't challenge, really. If the fear...
Well, you've got less of an appetite to challenge.
Mm.
You know, because do I want this argument? Do I want to? Is this worth it? And I get it, because when you walk past the window and there's 20 children, heads down, going at it, the head goes thumbs up to the teacher. Then you walk into a classroom where there's people, there's 2 feet hanging out of a bin because they're trying to get some electronics out. They're going to. It doesn't look as the same, but the learning is so much better, but there you go.
I mean, that's it. You've nailed it, really. In that the both things can be true at the same time. The results might be better, but you can't prove that the results are better because of the strictness. All you can prove is that the results are better than they were when things were different. But they could be different in a different way. So you could have improved the school without turning it into a sort of version of Charles Dickens's Do the Boys Hall. I don't know. And listen, just for the avoidance of doubt, if I had been having this conversation 20 years ago on this radio program, the same me, the same DNA, the same hotchpotch of experiences and opinions, I would have been, and I struggle to believe this, but I know that it's true because I was there, I would have been very hardcore in favour of strictness. Very, very hardcore. And I was at a school where sexual abuse was rife, where standing up to authority was punishable by violence, where creativity was encouraged in dark corners of the school that were frowned upon by many members of the teaching staffs. We managed, we found each other, both pupils and teachers, but of course that makes some pupils vulnerable to teachers who have nefarious intent. But I came out of that convinced that I was a beneficiary of it, even after getting expelled. Convinced that the stricter things were, the better I would have been, the better off I would have been. And I am absolutely of the opposite view now. I mean, completely and utterly of the opposite view. So it comes from a very personal place when I say that just because a child might think they're benefiting from or flourishing in an environment, give it 10 years, give it 15 years, give it 20 years, and then ask the question, then examine the evidence. Because unfortunately, some of the most repressed and therefore dangerous people ever to occupy public life in this country attended schools like mine and are my age or older. And that is part of the reason why our response to the pandemic that we were talking about a bit in the last hour was so inadequate and so awful. Because you're taught to sort of be frightened of consequences and therefore ignore them, perhaps. I don't know. I'm not an expert. I just know this, that growing up in fear does not a happy adult make. It's 11:45.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Labour MP and Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, Lisa Nandy, who joins me now. The Bob Villain story has raised its head again. The Daily Telegraph reporting that they've launched, that Bob Villain is launching a defamation lawsuit against the Irish broadcaster ITE and its coverage of their performance at the Glastonbury Festival. Now, 6 months ago, soon after that festival, you told the House of Commons you expected answers without delay from the BBC. Have you had that full report and when did it arrive?
I've been really frustrated and I think openly frustrated with the slowness of the action of the BBC leadership. But in this instance, I think they have recognised, in the chairman's own words, a catastrophic error.
We deserve to know more. We do pay for this organisation, Lisa Nandy.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last. Subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family, get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, stop up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with
TRIP. Think, do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
They did it again. Flour instead of flowers. On my birthday. And 95 minutes late. But it's hard to leave when you've shared so much. Your postcode, your gluten intolerance. Then I saw it. 25% off your first Ocado shop. Plus, free delivery. And I just knew I'd found the online supermarket of my dreams. Ocado. Life delivered. Geographical restrictions. Min spend £60. Max saving £20. Charges and Christmas restrictions apply. New customers only. Terms at Ocado.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard your flight to Geneva. This is your captain speaking, and I would like to take a second to welcome our very special guests, all the skis and snowboards that enjoy a free flight to Winter Wonderland.
The best winter holidays start with the right airline. Book your family trip to Winter Wonderland now on Swiss.com and enjoy free gear transport.
At Fidelity, we've been helping our customers plan for their retirement for nearly 20 years. From understanding how much you'll need, to combining multiple pensions,
We offer expert insights, excellent service, and even financial advice, so you can feel confidently invested in your future. For pensions, advice, or investment accounts, be invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Transferring is not right for everyone. Terms apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
11:47 is the time. And, of course, you may construe that the consequences of growing up in a climate of fear and then forcing yourself to become a person that can survive in a climate of fear, whether you're frightened of teachers or whether you're frightened of your fellow pupils, you can see the consequences sometimes in adults, and they are horrible to witness, really horrible. Particularly the people who manage to sort of thrive and survive, the personalities they've created to thrive and survive as a consequence of being brutalised at school can be almost heartbreaking. Which brings us to the question of who you think it was that in the last 24 hours described Brexit as being part of the things that are going wrong now and have gone wrong in the past. I asked you, was it A, Nigel Farage? Was it B, Cammy Badenoch? Or was it C, Jacob Rees-Mogg? And a surprising number of people answered all three, but you're not paying attention. None of these people ever admit the disaster that they've inflicted upon the country, unless by accident, which should have made it fairly easy to work out that it must be the one that never makes gaffes.
Adam Smith once said, "There is a lot of ruin in a nation. For all that is going wrong now, and let's be honest, has gone wrong in the past, it didn't all start under Labour, we know that nations can absorb shocks. Look at what we had to deal with, the financial crisis, Brexit, COVID, a war in Ukraine. We know, though, that countries with strong institutions and productive people do not collapse overnight."
So Brexit is part of the things that have gone are going wrong now and have gone wrong in the past. That's nice of her to admit it. I wonder if she even noticed. Back to cultures of fear. Before that, a quick word. One line from the investigation undertaken by Sir Alan Wood, one of the country's foremost experts in children's services. Here's a quote. "Rather than respond," because this tallies with a lot of the conversation we've already had, particularly Benjamin, actually, the former teacher, "rather than responding with curiosity, leadership dismisses concerns as vexatious or ideologically motivated." Takes us back to that lovely line about you can't innovate if you're terrified you're going to get things wrong that Emma sent in. And listen to this. "Practices like shouting have become so routine they are no longer recognised as harmful." And then I turn to another mother. I'm not reading out any names of parents. I can't triple check or prove that you're being honest with me when you say that your children go to these particular schools. But the question about a climate of fear is constant. But another mother who says that her child does. Listen to this. "I noticed my son shouted back at me the other week. He's never raised his voice to me before, but he's been at that school for 3 years now." Where would a child learn to shout if they're not shouted at home? If not at school. That is another little example of what a climate of fear looks and sounds like. Paul's in Liverpool. Paul, what do you reckon?
Hi, James.
Hello.
Nice to speak to you. First time I've called into the show.
Welcome,
yeah,
mate.
Yeah, cheers. Yeah, so grew up in Liverpool. I've recently moved to Hampshire. I was kind of motivated to call, reflecting on my experiences at school, and yeah. I've got three young boys at school. So I was 83, 84, in finishing primary school and juniors. I reckon I was right just at the end of the cusp where you were still getting a smack
off
the head teacher or the ruler getting sent. And, you know, in that particular school, Catholic primary school, I had an enjoyable experience. I think we had a good standard of learning. They really pushed us, athletic sports. We were out every lunchtime, cross-country and all that. So pushed us to achieve. But in terms of the climate of fear, I immediately listened to the show, thought back to the lunch hall as an example. And if a poor kid actually dropped a glass or a bowl that smashed, we'd all, you know, go, ooh, like a big exciting thing. I remember the head teacher would literally skid through the double doors, screaming.
Yeah.
Honestly, like a Dickens character. What the hell do you think you're doing? Honestly. And the other thing, I'll just call
him
Mr. R.
That's frightening. Imagine if your boss did that at work.
Yeah.
I had one once who did, and I'm still traumatised by it.
it was almost pantomime. And the other thing was, I mean, I'll call it Mr. R. Oh, you're going to get the shakes off Mr. R. And he'd come up close. Rather than shout, it was an aggressive whisper. He was that convulsed in anger. What the hell? He went up close, beetroot red face, and the kids would get shook like a ragdoll. And we're all observing and aghast at that. So, you know, that's my experience there.
Yeah, I mean, as you acknowledged at the beginning, the physical stuff no one would seek to defend or excuse anymore. But I think shouting can be just as jarring and upsetting as actual physical contact, especially that level of physical contact, that sort of the shaking and not you know, not the clattering or the, you know, the way you'd treat an adult, but doing things that the teacher would only do to a child. Shouting can be horrible.
Yeah. I think also, if I think of just some memories that pop up from that, I remember P class and we're doing like the high jump, you know, the pole gets lifted higher and higher. And one particular girl, just really having a fear of it, but being forced to jump out, and of course you can do it. And I remember literally physically crumbling, crying, saying, I can't, I don't want to, but being forced. And I don't know how she, I'm sure she must remember that and what impact that's had on her.
It will have done, We were talking about this with regard to Farage last week and his comments to Jewish pupils about gas chambers and Hitler being right, and nearly 30 of them now have gathered to confirm the memories of Peter Itegi, who I interviewed on Friday, and the suggestion that people wouldn't be able to remember. Admittedly, he changed his story pretty quickly after originally claiming that people wouldn't be able to remember. He then claimed that he absolutely could remember, and he definitely hadn't done the things. And then, of course, he had done the things, but they hadn't been racist. And then they had actually been racist, but they hadn't been hurtful. But the people who were the victims, the targets of that brutalization by a fellow pupil, albeit one who in some cases was 5, 6, 7 years older than the person he was abusing, they remember. The victims remember, I think, for the rest of their lives. I tried to find the letters page of the newspaper that was reporting on this. It was either the Times or the Guardian, but I couldn't find it, where people were simply saying, I was the victim of that kind of bullying, whether it was anti-Semitic or racist or not actually based in ethnicity or background. The people who were the victims of it remember. If you feel humiliated in a classroom full of people, you remember it, I think, for the rest of your life. And I suppose the number of kids that did get humiliated in a classroom full of people is relatively small, is it? Out of 40 kids, probably 5. To whom it happens all the time, maybe another 5 to whom it's happened once and would never happen again. So there's 30 kids there who don't really see the damage that's being done to their classmates and may not acknowledge the damage that's been done to them until much, much later. Paul, thank you. Kerry is in Bexley. Kerry, what made you pick up the phone?
Oh, right, yeah. So it's a subject that I think is really important. You know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, we know that schools exist to encourage attainment and for children to do their best. But the fact is, if a young person goes into an exam with really high levels of stress, they're not going to perform at their best because their mind will go blank. They won't be able to access the information they've got. That will happen when they're very anxious.
There's a gradient, isn't there? A little bit of stress can focus the mind, but it then becomes quite quickly, and it's hard to pinpoint precisely when, a very, very negative influence.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, of course it's important to have high expectations, and a little bit of anxiety, as you said, is really important. But if we're constantly talking about these things and making children so scared that if they fail, that it's going to affect the rest of their life, then it's going to be counterproductive. And as regards to being in a culture of fear, you know, I think there have to be boundaries and rules in society because they do help young people to feel secure. But there's a difference between having boundaries and rules and making people so scared that they don't, because they have no voice. And I think...
And what does it do to them? What if you had to pinpoint long-term impacts or long-term consequences of this? It not just for the children who are getting into trouble, but for the children who are witnessing the shouting and the children who are living in a climate of fear. What might we expect to see later in life, do you think?
Well, they're going to be in levels of high alert when they're in school, which is going to make it difficult for them to focus. And, it might make them more anxious moving forward, particularly if they've been targeted.
Permanent anxiety. What about short fuses and anger? People who have got kind of anger issues and don't necessarily know why, because they weren't able to process things as a child. They weren't able to question things. So they become...
if someone's experienced a lot of sort of difficulties in school or trauma, then in the longer term, or trauma, perceived trauma in response to an event that's happened in school, then they probably are going to have more issues around anxiety, around anger, maybe difficulties in relationships in the workplace. If you've experienced someone in a senior position shouting at you repeatedly in school, and then you come across a boss that's quite strict or managing you in a strict way, it's going to make it harder for that young person in the workplace to be able to
Except I bet the boss probably got shouted at a lot at school as well. So the behaviour then repeats itself. It's just not a good thing. People who can't control themselves, people who can't control their thoughts, people who fly off the handle. Let me read you a message from Mark. He writes, "You're the reason society and kids are totally out of control and have no respect for anyone or anything. Shouting is traumatising and upsetting, !! You woke left-wing tool, pathetic." So there's someone who's clearly been very traumatised as a child and hasn't learnt the skills that you need to deal with your own emotions. To lose control of your emotions in a message to a radio presenter is heartbreaking and tragic. And to reach for that sort of language in the context of a conversation about children who are struggling and an independent investigation that has described a climate of fear is... I say this with love, Mark. That's a mark of someone who has been traumatised as a child and is still trying to pretend otherwise. It's coming up to 12 noon. It's Wednesday. I nearly said Thursday. I misspoke in the last hour and about 40 people noticed, which I think is pathetic. Have you honestly got nothing better to do than to pick me up on tiny little verbal glitches? There is, lest you were wondering, no such thing, as far as I'm aware, especially in this country, as corporate punishment, especially if you're running a water company. I was not, for the avoidance of doubt, a victim of corporate punishment when I was a child. In fact, when I saw the first message suggesting that I had said corporate punishment instead of corporal punishment, I thought you'd made a mistake. But then I saw the second message, and the fifth, and the tenth, the 20th, the 40th, and then Keith joined in. So I clearly did say that I had been a victim of corporate punishment when I obviously went corporal. Just a sort of final word to Mark. That's why you're divorced, mate. That's why you're divorced, that inability to control your temper and your anger. But on we go. It is 12 noon. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, and Natasha Clark is here. She's been quite busy this week, Cammie Badenoch. She's sort of doing a bit of a Farage by having press conferences left, right and centre, regardless of whether there's any particular need to have them.
Yes, and I don't think there was any particular need to have any on Monday or yesterday with her second press conference of the week on welfare, which, to be honest with you, there wasn't a lot of new news in it. She's launched a new Get Britain Back to Work strategy. But those are two levers that we see her pull again and again at Prime Minister's Questions, don't we? Welfare and grooming gangs. Those are two topics which she clearly feels quite comfortable on. She might choose to go on that again today. Her other options, of course, the ECHR, again, another Cammie Badenoch favourite. She likes talking about how she thinks that the Tories would like to leave the ECHR. But a mystery one, Brexit. We were talking about this last week, weren't we? David Lammy's comments on our news agents global podcast about Brexit, which went, I think, a little bit under the radar last week about what he said about potentially rejoining the customs union.
Or refusing to rule it out. I mean, the same thing, really, isn't it?
Exactly. And would Cammie Badenoch like to press that heart, poke a little bit of salt in that wound for Keir Starmer today, potentially?
I wonder if he's noticed what she said yesterday about Brexit being a foolish policy that takes time to do real lasting damage, if you were to dig into the rubric of yet another speech that she's given. Is there mileage in that? Have you seen Peter Kellner's graph? It's a fascinating graph on where we are now. Leavers and Remainers, nearly double the number of people who would want to rejoin.
So many people have changed their minds, I think.
But also a lot of people have died, and I read nothing particular into this. They're much more likely to come from the Leave camp. I was struck by how few people have changed sides, even in the direction that you'd expect. It's more demographic change, new voters becoming eligible, and older voters passing away, rather than huge numbers of people realising, in my view, the error of their ways. Mm. But so I don't know if it's got mileage in it.
I think, as we talked about last week, about the idea that it could be a lever for economic growth for Keir Starmer to pull, definitely very convincing. Mm. There obviously are people in his own government that want him to make that argument, and that's exactly the argument that Ed Davey was making when he's spoken about this. So this could potentially be something for Ed Davey to mention. Brexit, Ukraine, potential the dumping of sausages as well. That's my wild card for today for Ed Davey.
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, for Ed Davey.
For a Davy, yeah, because of that sort of environmental aspect. So this is the story that hundreds of raw sausages have been fly-tipped near to the city centre in Bristol, because you remember he was talking about
they don't
that
know
big...
what to do about this.
No.
The government would have to pay the government to do it, and they can't afford to.
Yeah, and the Environment Agency, just clearly not something they were, not something they want to talk about. But
we will cross
that's
live
the wild card.
To the House, well, we shall see, to the House of Commons. I thought you were talking about an EU story, which would have been odd for Ed Davy.
No.
Paul McCartney objecting to the words.
Bendy sausages.
Sausages being removed from the description of vegetarian products shouldn't be allowed to be called sausages and burgers, because apparently people might accidentally buy a vegetarian product. They should be called things like discs and tubes.
Yeah, discs and tubes. I actually, you know, as a vegetarian, I actually accidentally bought meat sausages.
Yes.
It's a real problem for us all.
Well, clearly.
I had to keep them in the freezer. No one wants to eat them when they came around my house.
Live to the House of Commons the moment Kemi Badenoch gets to her feet to pose her first question. When do they break up?
This is the second to last one. So
it?
The next week, you can guarantee we'll put a video on, we've put a DVD on, we're just going to mess around.
They
right?
all wear home clothes.
Exactly.
Do the lesson in the playground.
Exactly. But this one, I think, may be the last serious
break up next week as well. So they're taking it relatively close to the wire. They'll finish on the Thursday, will they? The Thursday afternoon?
Yes, usually it's the Thursday before
the 18th.
Before Christmas. But yes, there's been a lot of different things that Kemi Badenoch could go on. There's been chat about the Grooming Gang's inquiry chair today, whether she will be a really truly independent, as she's formerly a Labour peer. It raised the question, we've talked about this lots of times before when Kemi Badenoch's talked about grooming gangs, whether there is anybody who can truly be independent in this process. And we talked about the former police officer, didn't we, Jim Gamble, about how his credentials for that grooming gang inquiry.
Here we go. Let's find out.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And can I echo the sentiments of the Prime Minister? The thoughts of the whole House will rightly be with the family of Lance Corporal Hooley, yeah, who tragically died supporting Ukraine in her fight for freedom.
Yeah.
Can the Right Honourable Gentleman tell the House, why are his own MPs describing him as a caretaker Prime Minister?
Mr. Speaker, my own MPs are very proud. We've just passed a budget which protected our public services and our NHS. No austerity which brought our NHS to the ground. We've created the conditions for economic stability with the headroom we need. And Mr. Speaker, we're concentrating on the single most important issue for families up and down the country, which is the cost of living, by taking £150 off their energy bills. That's in addition to the £150 for the 6 million of the poorest household. We're concentrating on what matters to the country. She's trying to save her job.
Mr. Speaker, let me answer the question for the Prime Minister. He's being called a caretaker because everyone can see that he's lost control of his party. And this lot, they're all so busy trying to replace him.
Order. Sorry. Can I just say, the same people are making the same noises they made last week. I did say last week it wasn't the right time. I wouldn't do it this week. So please, let's not carry on with the way we left it last week. Kemi Badenoch.
Mr. Speaker, they can make as much noise as they like. Yes. We all know that this lot are so busy trying to replace him that they've taken their eyes off the ball.
Yeah.
Let's start, Mr. Speaker. Wait for it. Let's start with the Energy Secretary, who wants to recycle himself as leader. He said he'd cut families' energy bills by £300. Can the Prime Minister tell the House how much have energy bills fallen by since the election?
Mr. Speaker, I'm very pleased to say we're taking £150 off energy bills. I can also tell her that that's on top of the £150 we've taken off last year for the 3 million poorest families, now for 6 million poorest families. Mr. Speaker, she talks about leaving. The problem for us, last week, three ex...
Well, Mr. May, I've told this side. I'll now tell this side. We don't need the pantomime auditions anymore, please.
Mr. Speaker, last week I pointed out that three of our ex-MPs went to reform. That included the former Deputy Chairman, Jonathan Gullis. He liked to think of himself as a straight talker. He said they're finished and they've lost the trust of the British people. In total, Mr. Speaker, 21 ex-Tory MPs have now left for reform. The real question is, who's next? We can all see the Shadow Justice Secretary twitching after his come and get me plea from a member of Clacton. Mr. Speaker, we need no lessons from them.
Mr. Speaker, I asked him about energy bills. You could power the national grid on all of that hot air. He promised to cut energy bills by £300. Energy bills have risen by £187. But let's look at someone else who's making a mess. Let's look at the Education Secretary. Oh, there she is. Labour pledged to recruit 6,500 more teachers. So can the Prime Minister tell the House how many extra teachers are there since she became Education Secretary?
More than when they left office. Yeah. I'm very proud to say so. We're in an upward trajectory. Oh, Mr. Speaker, they left our health service on its knees. They left our schools in a mess. They left our economy absolutely broken. They should be utterly ashamed of their record in service.
They may not.
Wrong. Mr. Speaker, there are now 400 fewer teachers since she came into office. She's shaking her head. It's on the DfE website. Does she not check it once in a while? I can understand that the Right Honourable Lady is angry. We're all angry at the mess she's making. The Prime Minister doesn't know what's going on in energy. He doesn't know what's going on in education. Does he know anything about what's going on in the Home Office? Last year, the Prime Minister promised to recruit 13,000 more police officers. How's that going?
Prime Minister.
3,000 more by the end of March, and we're rising on police numbers. Mr. Speaker, they left the Home Office. The criminal justice system is utterly broken. Sir Brian Leveson has said on that. They lost control of our borders. They lost control of every single department. And she's obviously spent the morning rehearsing for the Liz Truss show. She's probably going to be the guest star next week. Both of them talking about how Liz Truss was 100% right. But what Liz Truss said was the Conservatives need to take... No, they don't want to hear it. The Conservatives need to take responsibility. The Conservatives need to take responsibility for their 14 years of failure. That was Liz Truss, their former leader. So perhaps she'll heed that, get up and say sorry.
They may not.
Wrong again. I asked him how many police officers. There are now 1,300 fewer officers than at the election. So, Mr. Speaker, I don't know if the Home Secretary wants his job, but I do read that she's having conversations with Tony Blair because he's already given up on the Prime Minister. Why don't we talk about the Health Secretary? Let's see how he's doing. We do know he definitely wants the job. He said he'd end the doctor strikes. So can the Prime Minister tell the House how many appointments have been lost to strike action since last July?
Mr. Speaker, they left the NHS an absolute mess, with the highest waiting lists on record and the lowest confidence in the NHS ever. The Health Secretary said he would do 2 million extra appointments. He hasn't done 2 or 3 or 4, he's done 5 million extra appointments. That is because we invested in the NHS. What did they do, having broken it? They voted against that investment. They should hang their heads in shame.
Mr. Speaker, I asked him how many appointments have been lost to strike action. He doesn't know. Let me tell him. We have lost 93,000 appointments to strikes since the Health Secretary gave doctors a massive pay rise. It is... It's the truth. I know they wouldn't know the truth if it punched them in the face, but I'm telling them the truth. It is no wonder that we read this morning that the former Deputy Prime Minister has said about the Health Secretary she'd rather stick pins in her eyes than be on his golden ticket. And Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister congratulates himself on 5 million extra appointments. Yeah. In our last year of office, we delivered 6.5 million. Under Labour, Mr. Speaker, everything is getting worse. Jobs, bills, police numbers, teacher numbers, everything is getting worse. The Cabinet should be doing their own jobs. What are they doing? They're trying to compete for the caretaker's job. The only person who doesn't want the Prime Minister's job is the Chancellor. She's just trying to cling on to her own. Isn't it time, Mr. Speaker, that the Prime Minister admits that Labour isn't working?
Mr. Speaker, she's living proof you can say whatever you like when nobody is listening to anything you have to say. There's absolutely no substance. She's no credibility on the economy. She still believes that Liz Truss was 100% right. She wants to go back to austerity with £47 billion of cuts. She thinks the minimum wage should be frozen too high. She's got no credibility on foreign policy. She complains about trade deals she tried to get and we got. She says that we should stay at home and not attend NATO or the G7. On issue after issue, she's clinging on to reform. That's not leadership, it's weakness. No wonder so many are leaving her party. They know there's absolutely no reason to stay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thousands of families are moving into new estates only to discover that basic infrastructure, roads, drains and sewers remain in limbo, unadopted by public authorities. In mid-Cheshire alone, 4,700 households, more than 12% of all properties in the constituency, face this uncertainty with no guarantee over maintenance, safety and future costs, often years after developers have walked away. Can the Prime Minister say what steps he will take to make adoption timely and enforceable so homeowners are not left carrying the burden of unfinished infrastructure?
I thank him for raising this serious issue for his constituents and over 1.7 million homeowners across the country who are left at the mercy of unfair costs and poor management. I can confirm we're consulting on reforming this system to reduce private management of these estates and to protect more homeowners from unfair charges. That's a vital part of our leasehold reforms to protect homeowners from high cost and make sure everyone has the amenities that they need.
Sir Ed Davey, leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I join the Prime Minister in offering our condolences to the family and friends of Lance Corporal George Hooley, who died on duty in Ukraine? Our thoughts and prayers are with them. Can I congratulate Glastonbury's Lando Norris on becoming the 11th British driver to win the Formula One World Championship? And also everyone at McLaren's in Woking, who powered him to the title. Mr. Speaker, President Trump's new national security strategy is a deeply alarming document. Quite apart from the irony of President Trump accusing others of trampling on basic principles of democracy, it repeats far-right tropes of civilizational erasure and threatens that the US government will cultivate resistance in Europe. No wonder Vladimir Putin has welcomed that strategy. So will the Prime Minister pick up the phones and make it clear to President Trump that any attempts to interfere with our democracy are totally unacceptable?
Yeah. Can I join him in congratulating Lando for the incredible win? I went down to Woking on Monday to see some of the team at McLaren, and they're all wearing the pride that brought with them. On the question of Europe and President Trump's comments, what I see is a strong Europe, united behind Ukraine and united behind our long-standing values of freedom and democracy, and I will always stand up for those values and those freedoms.
Ed David.
Mr. Speaker, I didn't hear about standing up to President Trump. And if we're going to stand up to President Trump, we do need to strengthen our ties with Europe, not just on defence, but on the economy too. And the truth is, This government will not succeed unless it gets our economy growing strongly again. And the best way to do that is a customs union with Europe. The Prime Minister's chief economic adviser knows it. The Deputy Prime Minister knows it. And yesterday, the Labour chair of the Treasury Select Committee showed she knows it too when she backed our bill. Does the Prime Minister fear that if he keeps opposing a customs union, in 12 months' time, he will not be standing there?
Mr. Speaker, we have got a close relationship with the EU through our reset earlier this year. And yes, I do want a closer relationship than the one we've got at the moment. We are moving towards that. We do have manifesto commitments on issues such as single market, customs union and freedom of movement. But I would gently point this out, that having now done significant trade deals with other countries, including the US and India, which are hugely important to the JLR workforce and on pharma, it is not now sensible to unravel what is effectively the best deal with the US that any country has got.
Sir St. Giles.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Working in
18 minutes after 12 is the time, and one is struck not for the first time by the difference between Ed Davies' questions to the Prime Ministers and Kemi Badenoch's. It's not to suggest that Kemi Badenoch had a bad day, it's just to posit the possibility that Ed Davies was raising rather more important issues. We shall examine that exchange, and indeed that observation of mine, after this.
This is LBC.
To be honest, work had been a slog. I'm a designer, but some nights I was chasing invoices like my full-time job. Now Sage Copilot chases my invoices for me. I just need to click a button and it's done. And I get paid 1 week faster.
Sage Copilot is built with over 40 years of experience helping real businesses like Sophia at Solver Design. That's more than artificial intelligence, that's authentic intelligence. Search Sage Copilot to learn more. Working with 21 customers, each round payments came in 7 days faster with Sage Copilot. T's and C's apply.
Looking for a fixed passive income backed by real demand? With ulezprosperity.com, you buy the car, we rent it from you for a set period. You stay the legal owner and we pay you up to £600 per month in fixed rental income. No hassle, no maintenance, no tenants. It's a straightforward asset-backed rental agreement. Visit ulezprosperity.com for conditions and to learn more. That's ulezprosperity.com. Simple, steady, secure.
Unwrap daily surprises this December with the Lidl Plus Advent Calendar. Every day until Christmas, you could get exclusive offers like money-off coupons and even the chance to win a year's free shopping. Check the Lidl Plus app every day to open 24 unmissable offers. Lidl, more to value.
18 plus GB only, while stocks last. Minimum spend required. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. Top up on island fuel. Rest every 2 hours too. I inspect tire pressure and tread. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with
TRIP. Think, do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It is 20 minutes after 12 and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Would you, well, actually I think you went a week early with your description of panto season, to which you respond by saying, oh no,
he didn't. that was too easy. The one thing that you can actually lead me into. Yeah, exactly. We saw a very fun approach from Kemi Badenoch today. A bit of a pick and mix. She didn't really pick any specific subject to go in on. We heard from her talking about the health service, the Home Office, police numbers, teacher numbers, trying to paint this picture. And she sort of landed her payoff. Labour isn't working. Again, bit of a throwback to elections campaigns gone by. But I think not bad in the way that she laid out that argument, talking about the different sort of aspects.
Better lines as well. Do we know if there's been a change of personnel there at all?
Not that I'm aware of.
There were some good lines there. Yeah, I funny lines. But I mean, clearly scripted, but that's half the course.
Sure, and actually I think Keir Starmer is very, very good at sort of thinking on his feet and doing that off the cuff remarks. But actually I don't think he had quite as intense and good an answers to some of her sort of weaving questioning.
How loud is the talk in his own camp of leadership challenge? Because people get very cross when people like me start talking about it, because they think it's a right-wing media invention and I should know better than to get involved. But, of course, we speak to people who are close to the top of the Labour Party and they are talking about potential leadership challenges. But how worried should he be, do you think?
I think he should be worried. And actually, you know, when Ed Davey mentioned that, does he think he will be standing there in 12 months' time, that remark, even more cutting than anything Kemi Badenoch could say today,
it's,
right?
It's more man bites dog than dog bites man.
Exactly. Kemi calls for him to, resign every week and for the Chancellor to go every week. So it's nothing new, is it? But the way that Ed Davey did it, I thought, that's cutting. That worked, didn't it?
And that means that it is in the tea rooms, as they say, the major topic of conversation.
Every single person I talk to, every Labour peer, every person who has been inside Number 10, outside Number 10, everybody wants to hear what everybody else is saying. What are you hearing about leadership? Do you think that Wes Streeting, Angela Rayner will be the next person to lead the Labour Party? How long do you think Keir Starmer has left? It is a serious question, and it is not something that is brought up by us journalists and by the right-wing media or whatever. It is something that the Labour MPs are genuinely having conversations about themselves.
I'm glad you've clarified that. I think it's important to not talk about it would be remiss and weird, actually. And while we are talking about it, just remind us what needs to happen, because, I mean, it's not quite the same as the 1922 committee for the Tories, is it?
It's letters
of no confidence and things like that. How exactly does the end arrive?
So you remember what? I barely remember this. When Jeremy Corbyn was challenged for the leadership by Owen Smith, there has to be a challenger. They have to be nominated by a certain percentage of the Parliamentary Labour Party. And then we go on to have an election where Keir Starmer, sources close to him have said he will still fight. He will go up again. He's not going to go down without a fight. So he probably will stand if he genuinely believes that he's still got enough support within the Labour Party, rather. So it's not an easy process. And unlike the Conservative Party, you have to put your name to this. It's not anonymous. It's not done behind closed doors. It's not done with secret letters. You have to say, I want a different prime minister. And that's a big thing for any Labour MP to come out and say in public. And I think to date, I think only Clive Lewis, potentially one more Labour MP, has come out and said, I do think we should look about whether we need a new prime minister. Everybody else is talking behind closed doors.
And is there room for a stalking horse? Does someone start the process running by sticking their head above the parapet and then other people sit back and wait to see how things unfold before deciding whether or not they will break cover?
Completely. And right now they are having conversations about who that would be, whether that is something that they want to do now, whether they want to wait until after the local elections. You know, despite the mess that this government is in, despite the difficulties of this budget, I don't think he's facing anything imminently.
No.
I think that, you know, the political pressure has eased in the last few weeks from the government. They have managed to pull things around a bit. They've managed to get things back on a little bit of a less shaky footing. They've come forward with a number of announcements, you know, jury trials, several other things in the last few weeks. I think actually they are on a little bit of a less shaky footing rather than they were before.
I read today that Reeves has won the city's confidence, which could save taxpayers billions of pounds, but I read it in approximately 1/100th of the scale of coverage that was given to her exploits as a schoolgirl chess player last week. So again, we find ourselves wondering how does this stuff reach the public? For the avoidance of doubt, though, that was for me at least, I don't know whether you're a bit less ebullient, that was one of Kemi Badenoch's best performances yet, I thought.
You can see the confidence that's
coming
out of
her. There's a bounce there, isn't
there? Yeah,
do we know why?
Bounce.
Here's something that will surprise you. I recorded a podcast yesterday for Christmas Day, or it would be released either on Christmas Day or there or thereabouts, with the wonderful people who do the Quiet Riot podcast. And it's a review of the year, and you had to come up with someone who'd had a good year in politics. And I suppose the most obvious answer would be Zach Polanski. I went for Kemi Badenoch.
Okay.
But only on the grounds that she's still in the job, which, given where we were in January, is a magnificent achievement and a very unexpected achievement. What I don't get is the almost celebratory sense. I mean, like you say, she is extremely pleased with herself at the moment, but there is, and I know she generally is, but she hasn't been for much of this year. There's no evidence in the polls that she's doing anything differently or making any progress or making any movement at all. And yet there is a sense in the right-wing newspapers and on her own benches that she's sort of turning things or has turned things around.
Yeah, I think there is, you can notice within Kemi Badenoch the quiet confidence that is growing in her performances at Prime Minister's Questions. When she comes on the media, she's less defensive, she's less ratty, she's more engaging, she's calmer, she's more pleasant. And I think that she is doing better than she was doing a year ago. The idea that we're now talking about who will last longer, Keir Starmer or Kemi Badenoch.
That's a win for her.
It is a win for her. A year ago, it was obvious, oh, Kemi Badenoch is not going to last year. And I still don't know if she's going to last until the next election. But your point is, and Keir Starmer made this point in Prime Minister's Questions, no one's listening. It's not affected the polls at all. People still
so two
do
things
not
can be true at
her.
The same time.
Exactly.
She is doing
better.
A lot better, but nobody
cares. Exactly.
There it is.
On your economic stability argument, that ties into the sort of wider argument that the Labour Party are having, because it is absolutely key and crucial that, that Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves are key to the sort of stability that we are seeing. And you see that whenever there is talk about removing Rachel Reeves as Chancellor, we had such an instability in the markets. And MPs are talking about that. Oh, if we remove the Prime Minister, will this see economic instability go crazy? So who is there a candidate that can calm the markets? So that definitely ties in to this. But you're right. And you know, Rachel Reeves, despite so much economic pressure earlier this year from her backbenchers that she should rip up those fiscal rules, she stuck to it. And the city have, to be fair, backed her for it.
Yes. We'll wait to see whether it gets any more coverage tomorrow than it got today. Raphael Baer in The Guardian today writes about, it's a wonderful intro, headline as a question, the real battle on the right, who will be the MAGA stooge. And he's not alone in acknowledging the gravity of what Donald Trump has done in the last couple of days with this national security statement. Daniel Finkelstein, a Tory peer, very much in the room where it happens when George Osborne and David Cameron were preparing to run the party and the country. Andrew Neil, about as right-wing as it's possible to be without dropping off the map altogether, in the Daily Mail, coming pretty close to using the sort of language that is necessary when describing the sort of threat that Donald Trump poses both to the post-1945 world order and to European democracy. Badenoch didn't go there. And she could, because Ed Davey did, and discomfited the Prime Minister. So Kemi Badenoch is clearly not going to tack away from Trump in order to embarrass Starmer, which could be quite an effective tactic for her, as Ed Davey demonstrated.
Yeah, but if you do remember some of her first Prime Minister's questions, which we felt were really off top at the time, she was full-throatedly behind Donald Trump.
Yeah, so she can't go there.
I don't think she can go there.
She's literally siding with Vladimir Putin against Europe. That's not an opinion, that's counting. And she's boxed herself into a position where she has to, at the very best, stay absolutely silent. And at the worst, completely contradict her own early enthusiasm.
Exactly. So you've got Mr. Serious in the form of Ed Davey. I think he's the only one that can do that. And I have felt, and I don't know if I'm imagining this, a little bit more reluctance from Sir Keir Starmer to defend his relationship with Donald Trump recently.
Yes.
He talked there about a strong Europe. We're united behind Ukraine. We'll always stand up for those freedoms. You didn't hear him say anything about, I, you know, have a strong relationship with Donald Trump. I talk to him all the time. And Ed Davey's saying, well, you know, you might be defending these values, but when are you going to get on the phone and actually have a conversation with him and put these things to him? And he, you know, I can't remember the last time we had a readout from Downing Street about a call between Starmer and Trump. I don't know if that relationship is cooling, but I wouldn't be surprised if it were.
Well, it sort of has to. And he will be asked the next time he's in front of journalists about Donald Trump's hideous and unhinged attack on the democratically elected mayor of London.
Yep.
Nigel Farage will be furious. He's very, very strong on the inappropriateness of American presidents getting involved in British politics. He spoke of little else when Barack Obama was in the White House, so he, no doubt, being such a consistent, honest and decent man, will be furious American president.
He'll definitely want to set his own record straight on that. But yeah, some you know, absolutely, you know, disgusting comments about, you know, really personal comments as well. And that's something that, you know, Keir Starmer is not going to agree with, that sort of personal level of attack on anyone, let alone his own Labour mayor. And despite the fact that, you know, we read in the newspapers that he, Sadiq Khan and Rachel Reeves had a bit of a bust up a few weeks ago, and we know that Keir Starmer and Sadiq Khan they're not, you know, natural bedfellows, it's fair to say, but they are on the same team.
Quite good mates, but and with a similar background in the law, but
it's true.
But passionately opposed on Brexit, and quite possibly on some of the things Keir Starmer has done in order to try to keep Donald Trump sweet, which Phillips O'Brien from the University of St Andrews described to us in pretty stark terms yesterday as a terrible mistake, because you were never going to be able to keep him sweet. All you can do is dial down the hideousness briefly and temporarily before he dials it straight back up again, regardless of what you've done, how many knees you've bent or golden carriages you've laid on for his state.
Yeah, was it all a matter of time? Are we now, you know, the longer Donald Trump remains in office, the harder that will be for Keir Starmer. I thought on Brexit as well, he had that very interesting point at the end there to Ed Davey talking about trade deals. if we do decide to go to for a customs union, and he's insinuating that he doesn't want to do that, how do we undo the levels of trade deal, including that US deal? And he's using that today as an example of why he doesn't want to go back into the customs union. We can't undo that trade deal with the US that we've done. That's an interesting argument that we've not heard him make before, the idea that's why we can't go in.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, it depends how juicy that deal actually is. But yeah, you're right. It does change the story slightly. And yet, once again, this weird political landscape where you've got Farage's lot right out here on the right, then you've got the Tories tacking just an inch to the left of them on some issues and trying to get further to the right of them on others. Labour apparently pursuing that space despite this enormous vacancy that Ed Davey almost single-handedly occupies now. And it becomes clear every PMQs because he's talking about Brexit and he's talking about Trump's hideous behaviour, and none of the others are.
Yes.
It's incredible, right?
Yes.
Hey, Farage never can. He can never say boo to a Trumpian goose. Badenoch, as you've reminded us, has boxed herself into a similar, if not quite as confining, corner. Starmer has gambled on keeping him sweet. That gamble, if it hasn't already failed, is about to. And Davey's the only one who can actually report reality to the British electorate.
Yeah, I mean, he's coming across as Mr. Serious, isn't he? And Kemi Badenoch was coming across as the sort of pantomime fun character of poking holes in everything and making a big fun of this Labour government. So two very, very different approaches. Depends on what you want from your PMQs, what you want from your potential leader.
With a bit of both.
Yeah, I think so. I think
it keeps
it nice and fun, doesn't it?
Light,
but on Brexit,
shade.
On Brexit, finally, he didn't slap down David Lammy's comments about the customs union. Neither did Downing Street last week. I thought it was very telling that they didn't want to distance themselves from David Lammy. I wouldn't be surprised if they keep it open, even though I just don't think it's going to happen.
It's generational. I used to think it was. Whoever leads the Labour Party next, even if it is Keir Starmer, and he fends off an attack, I think that is when things will really start changing, because people will campaign for the leadership on a promise to do more get closer to Europe. And they'll campaign against Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
We shall watch this space with interest. Natasha Clark, thank you very much. That was so engrossing that I'm 4 minutes late for the headlines with Amelia Cox.
A 40-year-old man has been found guilty of murdering his ex-partner's sister and her three children in a house fire in Bradford. A court heard that Shiraz Ali was motivated by jealousy and fuelled by drink and drugs when he set alight the property in August last year. It's emerged a police officer accused of being involved in a grooming gang was allowed to retire under investigation. A former detective in the Metropolitan Police has told LBC the case was brushed under the carpet. And Sir Keir Starmer is suggesting changes to human rights law are needed to halt the rise of far-right populists. Britain is pushing for reforms to the interpretation of the ECHR to help tackle illegal migration. LBC weather, cloudy with showers for Scotland this afternoon. These will be more widespread in the north, mainly dry and bright elsewhere, a high of 14 degrees.
This is LBC. Listen on the move with the new LBC app.
Waitrose presents 3 for 2 on chilled party food.
Kelly, meet everyone.
Hi, nice to meet you.
8 guests, 1 host who knows exactly what will bring them together.
Food's ready.
Starring #1 king prawn toasts with crispy sesame seeds, soft polar bear bao buns bursting with hoisin veg filling, and meltingly tender Wagyu beef mini pies.
Waitrose, the home of food lovers.
Selected lines of stores subject to availability. Prices may vary in Channel Islands, Little Waitrose and Partners and concessions. Cheapest item free.
Take the world's best snooker players. One of the most unpredictable seasons. Add the electric atmosphere of Alexandra Palace. It can only be the 2026 Johnston's Paint Masters. Could it be Sean Murphy, Judd Trump, Neil Robertson, or world champion Zhaoxing Tong, who takes the trophy? One thing's certain, nothing beats the Johnston's Paint Masters live. Enjoy our biggest ever fan zone. Watch in style from VIP sofas. Book now. WST.TV/tickets.
James O'Brien on LBC.
12:36 is the time. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where our crime correspondent has once again produced a story which beggars belief, quite frankly. The headline does most of the heavy lifting. LBC investigation by Andy Hughes finds Metropolitan Police brushed under the carpet claims that an officer ran a grooming gang. It's a redolent phrase, isn't it, grooming gang, at the moment, Andy? I mean, it could equally as well have been described as a child sex abuse ring.
Yeah, and that's how it was originally described to me. A VIP paedophile ring is how it was described to me. So I started looking into the issue of grooming and paedophile gangs 3 months ago. And one of the first people I spoke to was a contact of mine, a senior detective, who told me that one of the priorities of the police investigating this at the moment is looking into cases of groups of men, and I quote, who do not fit the common understanding of a grooming gang. And I'm sure we'll get into that later. He told me he knew about a case involving a police officer targeting young children in care, and this all started when a young woman was arrested for a minor offence back in 2012. This woman was brought into the custody suite, and she recognised the custody sergeant behind the desk who she said abused her as a child. Now, this detective was made aware of the allegations at the time, and he's asked us to protect his identity.
This lady had been arrested recently. When she went into the custody area, she was shocked to see who the custody officer was. This lady had been in care as a child, and they used to run away from care, come into London. And she said that same officer used to pick her up with other girls sometimes, take her to an address in London where he and several other powerful men would sexually abuse them. And she didn't have any names of these men, but she thought one was a judge. And she just couldn't believe that it was still in the police.
So we're not naming the custody sergeant for legal reasons at this stage, but during my investigation, I learned that an unnamed MP and a judge were also accused of being part of this paedophile ring, and that a second victim had made basically identical accusations about the same officer. I spoke to a local councillor who supported one of the victims in one of the police interviews. This is Ruth Bush, who was Labour's first Lord Mayor of London, and this is what she told me.
She had been sexually abused as a child by a number of people, but particularly by somebody she would always just refer to as and they were all about eight, little tiny children, and she said they only picked the pretty ones. But it was undoubtedly connected to her experiences with in the police station. Certainly bad physical sexual abuse was perpetrated on her and on the others.
Do you know if the police officers who were interviewing her, did they give any indication that they believed her or not?
They did.
So despite the investigating officers believing the victim, this case was nevertheless dropped because the Met say, because of a lack of evidence. And the accused officer has been allowed to retire whilst under investigation, leading to claims of a cover-up.
Within a month, I was told he'd retired. At that point, you could not retire if you had an outstanding complaint against you. You couldn't resign and you couldn't retire. So I just thought they'd push under the carpet. Nothing's been done. I would have gone to his house and arrested him. I would have searched everything, seized all his electronics, brought him in, interviewed him, and he would have been released on bail. There's no way he, a month later, should have been just allowed to retire. Whoever made those decisions should be dealt with. They've taken the easy option. They've closed it down. But he needs to be prosecuted.
Do you think this is a cover-up?
Yes.
At the time, officers under criminal investigation could only retire with permission from a senior officer. The Met, however, was unable to tell us who had made this decision. LBC found that the accused former officer was now living in the north of England, and I approached him to put the allegations to him.
Hi, my name's Andy Hughes. I'm a reporter for LBC. Is it okay if we chat about some allegations? Here's a letter which details the allegations. The allegations relate to your time at the Met Police. And the allegations are that you sexually abused young girls when you were at the Met Police. Do you have any comments to that? Can you take this letter? All the details, Miss, all the details are detailed in this letter. It's got my contact details on, and you can respond to that. There's time to respond.
So that rustling was me posting the letter through his door because he shut the door on me when I put the allegations to him. The former officer later contacted LBC, and in a statement he said, "I categorically deny the accusations." However, the Met says it is now reviewing the case in light of our investigation and urged anyone with more information to come forward.
Andy, thank you. Just to clarify, the story that you are describing today wouldn't have come out at all, or certainly wouldn't have come out at this point, if you hadn't cultivated this contact, if you hadn't struck up a relationship with this very unhappy officer who had been sort of sitting on his unhappiness for the best part of a decade.
That's right. This officer tried to get justice for the victims, but he said that the Met took the easy way out, as he put it, and brushed it under the carpet, because the victim, who, because they grew up in care, had a troubled past, and the officers believed that it would be easy to dismiss.
And of course, that is a recurring feature of stories about grooming gangs, even and especially perhaps when that phrase conjures up images of people of a certain ethnicity. To clarify, that there is no ethnic minority dimension to this investigation. It's VIP, essentially.
Yes, the officer is white, the unnamed MP is white, and the judge is white, and I'm told everyone else in this paedophile ring is white.
How relevant, and you may not be comfortable moving into realms of speculation, is the date, do you think? In that people listening now, in 2025, may not quite know how different things were within police services culturally in 2012 and 2013, and that particularly for children in care, the appetite to investigate, the appetite to pursue, was considerably less than what we would hope it would be today.
Well, in fact, it wasn't, because in 2012, there was a very well-known paedophile in the news being investigated by the same force by the name of Jimmy Savile. So this was the biggest issue at the time, which is, again, adding to the idea that this was not given the attention it deserved.
And that's interesting, because Operation Midland, among the many criticisms of it, one of the easiest to understand is that people were working too hard to pursue allegations, because so many balls had been dropped with Jimmy Savile and with grooming gangs of largely Asian extraction in the north of England. So there's no historical reason or context in which this would make more sense than it does today.
No, and I think one of the biggest concerns for the victims and the people involved, including Met detectives, is that these victims were just so easily dismissed. And in fact, one of the allegations against this officer has vanished into thin air. The Met have no record of this story that this detective told about this woman being brought into the custody suite and recognizing her abuser behind the desk.
What happens next?
Well, the Met say they are reviewing it. They are saying that this will be done thoroughly to see if anything was missed, and if anything was missed, they may reopen the investigation.
Andy Hughes, LBC's crime correspondent, with an investigation about which you can read more on LBC, on our website, and of course on the LBC app, but which I sense isn't over yet. Before you go, mate, when you're on a doorstep like that, what's going through your mind? What is just for people who usually only see it on television screens or hear it on the radio, as someone who's doing it, what is going through your mind at precisely those moments?
Well, it's a key moment in the investigation, and this investigation went on for 3 months, and just tracking this former officer down took 2 weeks in itself, and then even then you don't know if the door you're knocking on is in fact that officer. We actually waited to identify him. We identified him, and then we knocked on the door. So I knew he was there, and I knew it was him. So it was just a matter of putting the allegations to him. And as a journalist, this is the moment we live for, confronting people who may have done wrong.
As I say, this story almost certainly not over yet. Andy, thank you so much. And you can, as I also say, read more on the LBC website or indeed on the LBC app. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Another story from the archives, as it were, coming up next, although no need for further investigation into this. Victims of the Windrush scandal still struggling to get support for their legal cases that should really have been not just established by now, but ring-fenced by now. We'll find out rather more about this after this.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Keir Starmer is urging European leaders to make it easier to deport illegal immigrants. But how? Change the ECHR or leave it? And what should youth services actually look like?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
While all the Whos of Whoville were at McDonald's eating, the Grinch from his lair started plotting and scheming. Gherkin-flavored fries and odd socks will send them crackers. So try the Grinch's new meal and head down to Macca's. Until 4th of Jan from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary while stocks last. Grinched for adults.
At Fidelity, we've been helping our customers plan for their retirements for nearly 20 years. From understanding how much you'll need to combining multiple pensions, we offer expert insights, excellent service, and even financial advice, so you can feel confidently invested in your future. For pensions, advice, or investment accounts, be invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Transferring is not right for everyone. Terms apply.
They did it again. Flour instead of flowers. On my birthday. And 95 minutes late. But it's hard to leave when you've shared so much. Your postcode, your gluten intolerance. Then I saw it. 25% off your first Ocado shop. Plus free delivery. And I just knew I'd found the online supermarket of my dreams. Ocado. Life delivered. Geographical restrictions. Min spend £60. Max saving £20. Charges and Christmas restrictions apply. New customers only. Terms at Ocado.com.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Stop up on island fuel. R. Rest every 2 hours to I. Inspect tire pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with
Think. Do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
Leading Britain's conversation. LBC with James O'Brien.
12:48 is the time. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. A little bit of background. I was watching the new BBC drama, The War Between the Land and the Sea, the weekend, featuring Colin McFarlane, and then I turned on my phone, or I went back to pick up my phone up in the kitchen, and Colin had been in touch with me, which is why he is here today, accompanied by Pauline Campbell, who is the pro bono lawyer at Justice for Windrush, and you are both here. This is where I sound really naive, because, Pauline, I'll start with you. I thought, after the work that you and your colleagues have done, that Amelia Gentleman at The Guardian has done, that the governments that were members of government that were brought to account, the apologies, the accountability, the transparency, I thought that victims of Windrush were going to be looked after. And I was wrong.
Exactly. That's the problem that we have. We believe that a number of people think that there is no longer a problem, that things are in the way they are actually as they should be, but that couldn't be so farther from the truth. Situation is, we've got hundreds and hundreds of people who are still being completely and utterly disadvantaged through a compensation scheme that is flawed. And as a result, a lot of people are not able to apply or seek advice because they've not got legal representation, because there's no legal aid.
I mean, a statistic to join all the other heartbreaking statistics is that 66 people now have died without having their claims settled. So those are people who had identified.
Exactly. People have actually passed away without their compensation. The problem is that the period of time it takes to get from the beginning, the middle and the end of the scheme is the nightmare process. And the mental issues that people have in dealing with this problem only exacerbates the problem. So without legal aid, without help, without support, they are on their own.
I mean, the problem, in a nutshell, is that the government said they wouldn't need any legal support. They wouldn't need, this is back in 2019.
Yeah, I actually read the Law Gazette report that came out that said you don't need legal aid. And the situation is, there's over 200 pages worth of guidance notes. The application is 44 pages long, the primary application. And along with that comes over 200 pages of pieces of work that you've got to read through. And they're saying you don't need representation. You can do it without. And that is...
I'm daunted just listening to you describe it.
I mean, I've done 300 hours worth of pro bono work this year alone. I get up at 5 in the morning, then I do the day job, then I go home, and then all weekend I'm doing it. Because people need me. They need our charity and other people like us doing this.
More on that shortly. In the meantime, Colin, just remind people listening who may have forgotten or not been fully aware of the kind of cases that Pauline is talking about, whether they have yet come forward or not. And if they haven't, we are encouraging them to do so, and we'll tell them more, or family members can pass on the information shortly. But what kind of characters have been caught up in this net, and what kind of stories have you been listening to now for the best part of a decade?
Well, there's so many. The most recent one was Hannah, who we actually had to go to Channel 4 News to get some justice for her, because she was in Ghana. She's been going back and forth, lives in London, been going back and forth to Ghana for years, and then suddenly she wasn't allowed back in the country, stuck in a hotel for 3 months, bills of £15,000, right? Wrote to Jeremy Corbyn, who tried to help, couldn't get anywhere, and they wrote to the Prime Minister, nothing, and someone knew about Pauline, so they contacted Pauline, Pauline contacted me, said, what do we do? I said, go to the media. We went to Channel 4 News, and the next day they had emergency travel documents, and she got back, and you go, but we shouldn't have to be doing this, what the hell? And then it was, in the end, they rang up £20,000 of hotel bills, which they've not been compensated for, and she still doesn't have a British passport, but they're on the way to doing something. But you're going, if you hadn't contacted us, you'd still be stuck in that hotel.
And we have no way of knowing how many people might have been caught up in similar limbo.
Correct.
Yeah,
that's
we've been
problem.
Talking to the Windrush Commissioner, and we've been working closely, because our aim is to change policy. It's not just about fixing Hannah's case. It's about looking at what the Home Office did wrong in her case so that it doesn't impact other people. And that's what I'm working with them at the moment doing. And what we want to do is we're insisting that any changes the Home Office say they want to do is that they meet Hannah, they meet the victims, they understand what they've been through and how they've been impacted before they make any changes, because they're not doing that.
We had another person, just to say, James, in Birmingham, the lovely Herbert, who came to us, who hadn't worked for 20 years. And I said, what was your average earnings? He said, about 30,000 a year, Colin, something like that, you know. And then I took a year off, and I then went back to work, and they said, where's your right to work papers? And I said, you are. Where's your right to? I've been working all my life. What are you talking about? And he said, I didn't understand the system. I didn't know what to do. So he got hold of us. I get hold of Pauline. We eventually do his application for him. We eventually get him £292,000. But if you actually calculate what he was owed, you're looking at more like 1.5 million. And I said, do you want to keep going? He said, no, because I've had to borrow money for so many years. I'm mentally screwed. I'm gone. I can't fight this battle anymore. And this is what we're dealing with. So,
and this is the other sort of statistical heartbreak. He went from zero to £292,000. Yeah. I know Pauline's piece in the Times last week, other case studies going from 20 to £170,000 thanks to charitable legal support. But the bit that really stuck with me, Pauline, was the simple comparison of what self-represented applicants receive on average, compared with what applicants who have received the legal help that the government in 2019 said they didn't need receive on average. And that is a gulf of £11,400 if you do it all yourself, and an average of £83,200 if you receive some legal help.
If you've received some legal help. We have to be Rottweilers on paper.
Of course.
Literally. And the lawyers themselves have to be Rottweilers in order to get any benefit and get any compensation. And the problem is how many people are getting nil offers. They're not getting any offers. And they're very, very rigid in how they apply the eligibility criteria. And so that is what I put in the Times. I made it very clear that the eligibility criteria has no discretion attached to it at all. And they're not even following their own guidance.
Right, let's get the housework done. Yes. What do people listening to this, whose mum or who themselves or their granddad is one of the people that hasn't come forward yet, or who has already been daunted by the scale of the red tape, what can they do? How do they get in touch with you or someone else who can help them?
Well, they need to contact me. We've got a general email address, and I'm Pauline@justice4.org.uk. We are a charity, and there's other charities out there, but our charity will advise, help you free of charge.
That's justice, the number four.
That's correct.
Yes, the number four.
Pauline at justice4.org.uk. We're also in partnership with the lovely Clifford Chance, who are taking on cases for us, because I said, Pauline, you can't do this all by yourself.
Yes.
So they've stepped up. And so we're providing a completely free service, and there's not many people doing that, but we are.
And we lead on that clinic with Clifford Chance. So I'm the supervising lawyer, so we work with them. But they've been brilliant in stepping up and helping us.
Credit where it's due. And of course, if people are a bit confused or have been misinformed, and if it turns out that they haven't got the case that they thought they have, they would also benefit from getting in touch with you.
And yes, because they need to have their voice heard. Even if they don't succeed, they need to be recognised that they they have a voice.
Yes. I'll share that email again in a moment. And it also very important to raise money, because as you mentioned, you're working pro bono.
Yep.
This relies upon charity. Colin, you are constantly rattling the tin on this. What's going on recently?
Well, you know, the wonderful Annie Lennox co-founded this with me, and that's helped us get the start we needed. So we're now in development for a TV drama. I won't mention the company and jinx it, but we've literally just signed a deal on that. And then we are in development with a documentary with BBC Studios, which is really exciting. And our aim really is that we give a lot of talks about this, and we discover that people go, oh, I thought I knew about Windrush.
Yeah.
And then by the time we finish talking to them, they go, I don't know anything about this. So we said, we've got to do big stuff that actually reaches right across the country. And so the only way to do that, very much like the post office scandal, you've got to do something that everybody's talking about. So we want to produce a thriller that in the midst of that thriller, you're being educated, but you don't know that's happening. Not unlike The War Between the Land and the Sea.
Yes.
It's about, you know, it's a big message about climate change at the heart of that, but you're watching a thriller.
You smuggle in the message.
So you smuggle, exactly.
Under the camouflage of the page turner, or the screen equivalent of a page.
So we've also got an ambassador program at universities. University of Lincoln have kicked that off for us. That's going to be reporting back in January. We want to have a Justice for ambassador every university in the country so that they can actually amplify all the work we're doing down here in London. So that our aim is before the next election that 80 to 90% of this country need to know the depth of this scandal. And the effect on its victims and survivors.
If people listening want to support the work that you do, they just need to go to Justice for Windrush.
Yes, and they
again,
can donate.
With the number 4 where you can make donations.
Thank you, yeah.
The first line of the article you wrote, Pauline, has haunted me since I saw it. When it says, I think they... This is Conroy Downey, a Windrush applicant, who simply says, I think they are waiting for us to die off.
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, that's why, literally, and that's why I do what I do. Because every second counts. Everybody that needs help are elderly. A lot of them are older now.
Yeah.
They've been in this country a long time, and they deserve the respect and the help that we can give them.
My father, 90, he was in the RAF, got an MBE from our lovely King Charles, and he said exactly the same thing. And that's actually in Spring 23. That was the interview that Annie Lennox saw.
Wow.
And then she got in touch with me and said, how can I help raise awareness about this? And that's where this whole thing began, and then it's just gone bigger and bigger with great supporters getting behind us like Ashley B and Patterson Joseph and Adrian Lester and AJ Tracy. And I think people just going, I didn't know. I thought this was over. I really didn't know. And what we've discovered is we went to Lincolnshire and talked to ladies in Lincolnshire where I live, where I grew up. And they just went to me at the end of our talk. They went, once you know, you care. And I went, that's exactly right. And we have to get more people.
So the more people know, the more people care.
Yeah.
If you want to get in touch with Pauline because you think that you or a family member may be in a position where she and her colleagues can help, then it is pauline@justice4, that's the number 4.org.uk. Otherwise, just Google Justice for Windrush again with the number and find out more about what Colin and his colleagues and Pauline and others are doing in order to both raise money, raise awareness, and raise the likelihood of people actually seeing justice. Because, to coin a phrase, justice delayed is justice denied. On a rather different note, has your dad been watching The Ashes?
He loves cricket.
I know he does.
Well, you know, you were there. He watched that. That's what keeps him. This is my mother passed away. My dad is 90,
yes.
And he lives in Lincoln, and that's what keeps him going. The cricket's on. He's coming down for Christmas, but he also did leave me a lovely message saying, I had no idea you had such a prominent role in The War Between the Land and the Sea.
Nice.
And I was going, yeah, I didn't really want to tell anybody. I just thought,
Thanks, Dad.
Let people tune in.
But, Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, it's a great show.
Great to see you, Colin. It's an absolute pleasure to meet you,
Thank
Pauline.
Thank you for inviting us today.
Well, you must
it's
let
so
me know.
Important to have
you
this
must let me know what else I can do. This microphone is yours.
Thank you.
I'm a Rockweiler. I will be in touch.
I've got that impression. Thank
and
you so
for everybody
much.
Listening, please tune in on Sunday, 8:30, BBC One. The War Between the Land and the Sea.
Actors,
you mean it?
just slightly, Sheila. Only a little bit. Yeah, it gets very scary next week. Tune in.
Colin McFarlane, who I should have probably said at the outset, is the founder and CEO of Justice for Windrush, where Pauline Campbell does her extraordinary work as a pro bono lawyer. Thank you both. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on Global Play, which is free, or the new LBC app, which is also free. You can stay up to date on the top stories and opinions, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, listen to a range of podcasts, including mine, every day. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Tom Sorbitt with you at 4 on LBC, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, James. The government says it will revive youth services with youth clubs and larger hubs, that word again, with a lot of services under one roof. Kind of sure start for teens, it seems to me. Will it work? Is it what young people need? I'm going to be joined this hour by the adult children of John Smith. Not a kind of a name you might not remember despite its ordinariness. His abuse of children and young people brought down the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. His two adult children join me to talk about the impact his crimes have had on their lives as well. I'm going to start though with Keir Starmer and the European Convention on Human Rights. He says, let's change it. The Tories and Reform say, let's ditch it. Who's right?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, LBC has been told a former Metropolitan Police officer was accused of being part of a grooming gang, but the case was brushed under the carpet. Two women who grew up in care made allegations against the custody sergeant in 2012, but it was dropped because of a lack of evidence. We can now reveal he was allowed to retire under investigation. A former detective, whose voice we've changed, believes there was a cover-up.
I would have gone to his house and arrested him. I would have searched everything, seized all his electronics, brought him in, interviewed him, and he would have been released on bail. There's no way he, a month later, should have been just allowed to retire.
The Met says it's reviewing the case and has encouraged anyone with information to come forward. A 40-year-old man has been found guilty of murdering his ex-partner's sister and her three children in a house fire in Bradford. A court heard that Shiraz Ali was motivated by jealousy and fueled by drink and drugs when he started the fire in August 2024. Ali was also found guilty of the attempted murder of his former partner Bryony Gawith's sister Antonia. She spoke outside court earlier.
Even with justice, nothing will ever make this right. Nothing will ever fill the silence where their laughter should be. Nothing will ever bring back our family. We will forever carry this brokenness, and yet we will hold on to them tightly in only ways we can now, through our memories, our photos, and our precious videos. Those are all we have left now.
Ali was tried alongside 26-year-old Callum Sunderland, who was found guilty of manslaughter but not murder. The Prime Minister has suggested changes to human rights law are necessary to fight off the rise of far-right populists. Britain is pushing for reforms to the interpretation of the European Convention on Human Rights to help tackle irregular migration. The Tories and Reform wants the UK to leave the convention completely. Rachel Reeves says she and the Prime Minister decided as a team not to raise income tax while appearing in front of the Treasury Select Committee. The Chancellor also hit out at too many leaks in the run-up to the budget, telling MPs it was frustrating. And figures from Ofcom suggest British children aged 8 to 14 are spending nearly 3 hours online every day. The communications regulators warned youngsters are spending significant periods on devices late into the night. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 27 points at 96.69. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.14. LBC weather, cloudy with showers for Scotland this afternoon. These will be more widespread in the north, mainly dry and bright elsewhere, a high of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. I've got a very busy programme today with not just conversation with you, of course, which is always front and centre, but I've had a conversation before I came on air with the most recent but now former Prime Minister of Iceland. Katrin Jakobsdottir is her name. Really interesting conversation, touching on a number of different things. You'll hear that a little later in the programme. We're all going to be also going to be speaking in the next half an hour or so to the adult children of John Smith, an ordinary name, but not an ordinary man. He brought down the Archbishop of Canterbury, essentially, his abuse for years of over 100 children and young people. And Channel 4 has made a documentary about it and the impact of it, of that abuse on his own children, not just that wider story affecting Justin Welby and the Archbishop of Canterbury and the whole of the Anglican Church, certainly here in the UK. So that's after 1:30 here on LBC. But I want to begin with something that is talked about a lot, mentioned a lot on this programme, certainly when we talk about immigration, and that's the European Convention on Human Rights, the ECHR. The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is urging European leaders to reform human rights laws to make it easier to deport illegal migrants ahead of talks taking place about a potential shake-up of the European Convention on Human Rights. From our perspective, that's being led by David Lammy. Talking to European partners to modernise the ECHR is the language that the government is using in its press release for it, to tackle illegal migration and to secure the future of the convention itself. Now, unlike Labour, unlike the government, the Conservative Party and Reform most definitely think we should be scrapping the ECHR, the European Convention on Human Rights, which has its roots in a very different time, of course. But I guess human need is human need whenever it happens. But there's clearly a growing appetite for something to be done about illegal immigration and the use of that law. Although some states say the use of it is overstated, is exaggerated, but the use of that law when it comes to governments being able to deport those it wishes legally to deport. So is scrapping it the answer or is changing it the answer? The government clearly thinks the latter. What do you think? 0345 6060 973. Now, these things can be difficult to get your heads around when you don't know them in great detail. I don't know it in great detail. Professor Catherine Bernard joins me, Professor of European Law at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at UK in a Changing Europe. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
It's been a while since we spoke. I think the last time we spoke, it was all post-Brexit trauma, wasn't it? Yeah. So look, on this, what does the convention provide for when it comes to deportation and immigrants trying to defend their right to stay in a country?
Yeah, there's two main treaty provisions which are relevant. Article 3, which is about inhuman and degrading treatment, and Article 8, which is on the right to family life. Now, up until very recently, lots of people who were threatened with deportation said, look, I've got my family here, my kids are in school, I shouldn't be deported to another country, particularly to countries where they would